For September 27th at 2021. It is 6 p.m. This call to order is given under public health conditions.
Here I am.
Consistent.
Sorry. Hi, guys.
Oh, good evening, Councilmember Robert.
Evening.
So we are just doing a call to order.
Old link.
So we are doing our call to order. So we're under public health conditions and consistent with the governor's executive order N-29-20. This meeting is being held by teleconference only until further notice. This meeting can be viewed on channel 20 and is available on live streaming on the city's website and on www.slow-span.org. And members of the public may provide public comment during the course of the meeting by calling in at 805-321-6639, and that phone line is currently open. So if you would all join me in a moment for a moment of silence as we reflect upon the circumstances and the conditions that we find ourselves in. But if you would take a moment to kind of reflect upon those in your hearts silently amongst and in the silence of your own mind. So if you would, please. Thank you, everyone, for that moment of reflection or that moment of silence. So if you would now please join me in asking Parks and Recreation Commission Chair Mr. Jeff Almashot to lead us in the flag salute, please. If you would all mute yourselves except for Mr. Almashot, he can proceed with the flag salute. And you are, sir, currently still muted.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with justice for all. I'm sorry. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Great. So, thank you for that flag salute. And now I'll turn it over to our city clerk for a roll call, please.
Councilmember Robert.
Here.
Councilmember Rushing.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Here.
Mayor Lee.
Here.
And please let the record show that Councilmember Miller is not available. She is absent.
Very good. Thank you for that roll call. We do have a quorum, so we will proceed. And that takes us to our closed session announcements, where Mr. Hale, our city attorney, will provide any of those if we have any.
Thank you, Mayor. We do not have any announcements from closed session this evening.
Very good. Thank you. Then I will close that and bring it back to our agenda review, where at this time the council may review the order of business to be conducted and receive requests or make announcements regarding any changes in the order of the day. So let's see if any members of the council have any changes or suggestions. Otherwise, I will accept a motion to proceed as published.
Hearing no changes or suggestions for changes, I'll make a motion that we accept the consent agenda as presented.
Actually, we're going to, this is just the agenda. So we'll get to the consent agenda in just a moment.
Just moving things along here. So I'll change that to the consent agenda.
Actually, we're gonna hold the consent agenda. We're just gonna do general agenda review.
Agenda. Oh my goodness gracious.
I'll go ahead and second that for the purposes of moving forward. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Very good. Thank you, everyone. So we have an agenda that we will proceed towards with, and that'll take us to our ceremonial calendar this evening, where we are pleased to have our Parks and Rec and Beautification Commission Chair Jeff Almashot, and looking forward to an update on the happenings at the Parks and Rec Commission. So, Mr. Almashot.
Okay. Thank you, Mayor. So as I think everybody knows, the Parks and Rec Commission is an advisory board to make recommendations and support the staff in the and the amazing work that they're doing. One of the really exciting things is just the progress that we've made, and I think the growth that we've seen in this the commission, the way we operate. We had interviews last week for our open seat for our fifth commissioner, and we had wonderful people apply. It was really exciting to see the caliber of person that was that we interviewed, and I'm really excited for I think later in this meeting when we'll announce who the new member is, but it's really it really speaks to how far we've come and I think where we're going, which is really exciting. So some of the things that we're working on, and one of them that's really very close to my heart and the reason I got involved in this commission in the first place is public art. The utility boxes that are in the community up and down Grand just look amazing. We had a committee that helped us choose the artists, and I think the quality that came out of that project is something really exciting. We are looking at public art as a real focus of this commission, how we can bring more of it to the community. And one of the things that work has allowed us to do is also do some other murals on private buildings. One is on the side of Second Chances Thrift. The other is on Hole in the Sky. I think a number of people on this call, including the mayor and some of our council members, participated in that. And then, of course, we did the mural on the fence at Stone Soup this year, which is a tribute to Grover Beach. So we're very excited that those things have been able to happen. I'm also going to tease a project that is coming up for discussion called Project Blackboard, which is proposed to take place at the Mentone basketball court. So we're very excited about that, and I hope that you are all equally excited to learn more about that as we look at making that a reality. Some other things we worked on, the 16th Street Playground, getting the new equipment. We're very proud of the equipment that's there. One of the things we were able to focus on that I think really speaks to the heart of our community is making sure that we had play equipment that was accessible for children with disabilities so that everybody in our community could participate. But overall, the equipment has been really well received. It's being used every day, so we're super excited about that. Recently, at our most recent meeting, about 2 weeks ago, we had a discussion about making upgrades to the current skate park. Grover Beach was the leader in having the first skate park in our overall area. But there are some upgrades that need to be made, and we're looking at we made some recommendations to help those go through. And then what we're looking at is can we build a new skate park at some point at a new location sometime in the future? So another really very exciting thing that we're looking to do. Another development of a softball park, development of softball parks. We're working with some softball teams to do that. We also we've done beautification awards along with things like the awards for the Holiday of Lights tour. Those are two things that we're looking to really enhance. And as we now will have five full commission seats filled, we're really looking at how can we do more awards, bring more attention to the wonderful improvements that people are making to their houses every day, but also what people are doing during the holiday time. So we're really excited to do that, and I think you're going to see a lot of really positive change and exciting things coming from that. So the other things that just in general that we're supporting, which Parks and Rec is doing, are classes, concerts, the holiday parade, the tree lighting, and the exciting snow slide that we're going to have this year at the holidays. So that gives kind of a broad overview of the exciting things we're doing. We would encourage people to visit groverbeach.org for more information or follow us on social media. The other thing that people can look forward to is a postcard with all of the events for winter and spring will be coming to everybody who is a resident of Grover Beach. So thank you so much for this opportunity to share with you all of the exciting things that we're doing. And we welcome your input and look forward to serving the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Amashata. Appreciate that update. Don't want to get into a full discussion of Parks and Rec tonight, but let's see if there's any quick questions that council members may have. So Council Member Bright.
Well, that just all sounds incredibly exciting. You're correct. The Parks and Rec and Beautification Commission has just come so far, as has our city. I started on the Beautification Commission, is what it was called, way back. And basically all we did was hand out beautification awards. So I'm just really pleased to hear all the good things that are happening, and I just can't wait to see it all. And I really love, I love it all, but I like the postcard idea. I think that's really, really important that we send that out so that all of our residents know what's going on. So, you know, they have an opportunity to get involved and to participate. So I appreciate you being here and giving us that information. So thank you so much.
Very good. Councilmember Rushing, do you have any quick questions for Mr. Elmer?
I have no questions. I just want to say thank you, sir. I love where this commission is going, and I can't wait to see where it goes forward with your new board pulled together. Thank you, sir.
Very good. Councilmember Roberts.
No questions either, Mayor. Thank you, Jeff, for all the hard work you do, and keep up the good work. City's looking beautiful. Thank you.
And I will echo those same comments and say thank you to the commission, past and present. As Mayor Pro Tem Bright mentioned, she started with the Beautification Commission, and I actually started my community service for Grover with the Parks Rec and Beautification Commission as well. So it's a great place to start your participation in community service in Grover, and we definitely appreciate all the members that have come through that commission, and looking forward to have a fully activated, fully engaged commission in about probably 10 minutes for you to get that moving forward. And then perhaps I can kind of, in the city manager will indulge me and see if the council is up for perhaps a joint meeting with the Parks Rec and Beautification Commission, perhaps early 2022, for us to kind of dive back into some of the items that Mr. Amashat brought forward tonight, and to kind of learn about those along with the community as we move forward. If for Mr. Bronson, perhaps you can kind of give us a quick update on that, if that's possible.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and good evening, council members. It has been a little while since the council has last met with the Parks, Recreation, and Beautification Commission. I believe 2018 was the last joint meeting that we had between the two bodies. And I think it would make sense, to the mayor's point, to convene a joint meeting. There's a lot happening with the commission, a lot happening in the space of Parks, Recreation, and Beautification in general. And it would make sense to convene both bodies in the first quarter of 2022. And pending your direction, staff will work together on that.
Very good. I think I see a kind of a head nod of consensus. So we'll let everyone work together on that, and we'll look forward to having that conversation. And thank you for all your activities. Thank you to park staff for getting us through COVID with a sensibility of mental health by having activities outside that have been participatory, and really getting a good sense of input from the commission as to how to keep that going. So thank you very much for that. Very good. So unless there's any last minute comments from Mr. Bronson or Ms. Petker, and I see Ms. Petker has unmuted herself, so I'm guessing she may have a comment or two.
I just want to thank the council and commission for all the work that you do to keep the community in a positive light and all the activities we're able to offer. So thank you very much for your support.
Very good, and thank you for all that you do. So great, definitely appreciate all of that hard work, and we will say thank you to Mr. Almashot for the presentation tonight, and we'll see you perhaps in just a couple of minutes for the Planning Commission filling of the vacancy discussion. So that will take us to our presentations this evening, where we don't have any formal presentations, which then moves us to our public communications, where at this time the council will allow public communications where any member of the public may address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes total on any item of interest within the jurisdiction of this council. The council will listen to all communications. However, in compliance with the Brown Act, the council cannot act on items that are not on tonight's agenda. So if anyone does want to call in under public comment, it's area code 805-321-6639. And I'll turn to our city clerk and see if there's anyone on for public comments.
No, we have no one on the line.
Very good. I will go ahead and close public comment, bring it back to the council, where we are now about to proceed to our consent agenda, so much to the happiness of Mayor Pro Tem Bright, where we do have a number of items that are being considered as routine items that are for consideration on the agenda tonight. Let's see if there's any members of the council that have any questions on the consent agenda. I'll start with Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Thank you. No, I have no questions on the consent agenda.
Very good. Councilmember Roberts?
No questions, Mayor. Thank you.
Very good. Councilmember Rushing?
No questions, sir. Thank you.
Very good. I just had one more of a comment than a question, but just there is a reauthorization of the Community Development Block Grant coronavirus response rounds of 2 and 3. And if, as the item says, this is just kind of a reaffirmation of that. I believe the city manager can provide concurrence that it is moving forward, and this is really just a cleanup issue that the state is requiring of us. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Mayor. This is just reapproving what you already approved using a new template from the state.
Very good. So I was appreciative of the state to change templates in the middle and then require a reapproval of that. But let me check in with the city clerk and see if there's any members of the public that want to make a comment on the consent agenda. And again, please call in at 805-321-6639. I'll turn to our city clerk, see if there's anyone on the line.
No, we have no one on the line.
Very good. I'll close public comment on the consent agenda and bring it back to the council for consideration, please.
Well, I'll make that motion that I was so anxious to make earlier, that we accept the consent agenda as presented.
I would gladly second that.
Very good. We have a motion and a second. Madam City Clerk, roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Yes.
Councilmember Rushing.
Yes.
Councilmember Robert.
Yes.
Mayor Lee.
Yes. Very good. So we do have an approved consent agenda. Thank you for that. That will take us to our public hearings, of which there are none this evening. So that takes us to our regular business tonight. We do have four main items tonight. So if anyone does want to call in under our regular business items, please do so at 805-321-6639. And our first item is an appointment to the Park, Recreation, and Beautification Commission. And I'll turn it over to our city clerk, Wendy Sims.
Good evening, Honorable Mayor and Council Members. In June of this year, Commissioner Debbie Guerra resigned from the Parks, Recreation, and Beautification Commission. Ms. Guerra's term would have expired May 31st, 2024. To fill this vacancy, the city advertised the vacant position in news releases and local papers, on social media, along with postings on the city's website and the bulletin board here at City Hall. The city received 5 applications, all qualified applicants, and on Monday, September 20th, an advisory body screening committee comprised of Mayor Lee, Councilmember Rushing, and Parks, Recreation, and Beautification Commissioner Chair Almashot conducted virtual interviews. The applicants were advised that the council would be requested to confirm and approve Mayor Lee's appointment at tonight's meeting. At the conclusion of the interviews, Mayor Lee recommends for council's approval the appointment of Sage Lasobi to fill the remainder of the four-year term on the Parks Recreation and Beautification Commission, scheduled to expire on May 31st, 2024. It was also recommended that Chantel Riley be recommended as an alternate to the commission should there be a vacancy prior to the next term expiration of May 2023. The council is being asked to accept and confirm Mayor Lee's recommendation and adopt a resolution to appoint Sage Lasobi to the Parks Recreation and Beautification Commission. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Sims. Let's see if there's any questions from the council on that presentation. So we'll start with Council Member Rushing.
No questions. Thank you.
Very good. Council Member Robert.
No questions, Mayor. Thank you.
Very good. Council Member or Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Thank you. No questions.
Very good. Thank you. So let's go ahead and see if there is any members of the public that want to speak on this item. If so, please call in at 805-321-6639. And I'll turn over to our city clerk and see if anyone has joined us for public comment on item number 7.
No, there's no one on the line.
Very good. I will go ahead and close public comment on item number 7 and bring it back to the council for consideration. And I'll just make a brief comment first, if I might, in the fact that as our city clerk mentioned, the applicants were stellar. We had 5 very qualified candidates. We had a very good discussion, great interviews with each of them. So, and we kind of took a look at the applicants. And as Mr. Almashot had mentioned during the course of the interviews, there may have been a voice that was potentially missing from the mix of the commissioners. And so we really took a look at how each of the applicants fit into that voice and into what the commission might be looking for from a range of ages, genders, from family to longevity of community involvement, and really landed on Sage Lasobi as the person who was best suited to fit that position at this time. And so before I turn it over to comments by council members, I want to turn over to Mr. Almashot and see if he wanted to add anything.
Nothing in addition. I think that the comment about filling that the having a different voice join us, I think is really exciting. I think he's going to bring a new perspective that is really needed, and I think that's really exciting. Thank you.
Very good. So let's see if there's any questions or comments that might have been generated by my comments or by Mr. Almashot's comments. So I'll turn over to Mr. Rushing first to see if there's anything he wants to add.
Very briefly, it was a pleasure to meet with all of the candidates that were applying for this position. Everybody was incredibly well qualified. And to your point, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Lasobi is, I think, really well positioned to balance out our commission. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how this commission moves forward and develops further with our Parks and Rec in the future. Thank you.
Very good. So, Council Member Robert.
No questions, Mayor. Thank you.
Very good. Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
I'd just like to say I'm just so pleased to see the number of applicants we had. And I'm just really excited to see where we go from here. So, I just want to thank everyone for their participation. And so, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Very good. So I will go ahead and open it up to any member of the council that wants to make a motion to confirm the appointment, or I can do that if no one unmutes themselves.
I will move to confirm the appointment of Sage Lasobi to the Parks, Recreation, and Beautification Commission.
I'll second that.
Very good. We have a motion and a second, and just a friendly more direction towards staff is that in the staff report, it did mention Ms. Riley as a filling an unexpected vacancy. Do we need to include that in the motion, or can that be just direction to staff as outlined in the staff reports?
Direction to staff as outlined in the staff report would be fine, Mayor.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Hale. So with that, we have a motion and a second. I'll turn it over to our city clerk for a roll call, please.
Councilmember Rushing.
Yes.
Councilmember Robert.
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Yes.
Mayor Lee.
Yes. Very good. So with that, we do now have a fully constituted Parks, Recreation and Beautification Commission. And if Mr. Sage Lisobi is on the line, be happy to have him come forward and introduce himself and say a couple words if he's so inclined.
All right. Am I here?
I can hear you. Oh, okay. Here you come. There you are. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm really excited to get moving forward here within the community. Just in brief, I grew up here in town, went away for college, and had the opportunity to buy a home off 6th Street, where I reside now full time. So, like I said, I'm really looking forward to working with each and every one of you. And like I said, moving forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your willingness to serve, and welcome to the Parks, Rec, and Beautification Commission.
Thank you.
Very good. So that will conclude our actions and our items on that appointment. And so we'll turn next to our item number 8, which is our short-term rental program update and policy direction. If anyone does want to comment on this item, please do so by calling in at 805-321-6639, and I'll turn it over to our Community Development Director Buckingham and our Senior Planner Castillo. Gentlemen, the floor is yours.
Mr. Mayor, Mr. Castillo will be giving the presentation tonight.
All right. Good evening, City Council members. So before you this evening is a program which was enacted back in 2019. Next. So in June of 2019, the City Council adopted a short-term rental ordinance that regulated vacation rentals in the city. So prior to this adoption in June, the city staff had worked with the council through 2018 and 2019 to establish this ordinance. And once completed, it established a citywide cap for non-owner occupied rentals. It also established a maximum number of renters and guests based on the number of bedrooms. It created an inspection and self-certification program. So the inspection was initially for non-owner occupied rentals and a self-certification program for owner occupied rentals. It also established a complaint hotline and portal, which is currently hosted by Host Compliance, or a third party vendor. It required neighborhood notifications for non-owner occupied permits. And so just really quick, a non-owner occupied permit is essentially a vacation home that's not occupied by anyone in the house. It's sort of a second home for folks. And so this notification radius is approximately 150 feet. And finally, required establishment of a local contact so that in case of emergency or any complaints, that local contact would be readily available as quickly as possible to remedy any situations and also to alleviate additional calls to our police department for these non-emergency type of situations. Next. So after this ordinance was passed in June of 2019, city staff made quick work of ordinance implementation. So we worked diligently with Host Compliance on setting up a website and a portal to apply online. It also launched a website that was dedicated simply solely to short-term rentals. We used the short line str.groverbeach.org to make implementation a lot easier. In addition, we created a YouTube channel with tutorials. So what that meant was we understood that since we are going into a digital realm for applications, we figured some folks need a little bit more assistance than others. So we went ahead and created a series of tutorials for folks to follow along and make it as simplistic as possible to make an application and apply online. And finally, we hosted a workshop to navigate the application. So once city staff had completed work with Host Compliance and setting up how the application would work online, we went ahead and emailed out to a significant amount of folks who had signed up for interest cards and online forms. And we hosted a workshop in person, but we also taped that meeting and posted it on our YouTube channel. Next slide. So all that work was done during the summer of 2019 in anticipation of what we called launch day program implementation. So our permit portal opened officially on October 1st, 2019 at 9 o'clock in the morning. Within the first 60 days, we received approximately 96 applications. All these applications were completed and inspected by folks in the community development department. And we basically completed all of these applications and did in-person inspections by December. Again, as part of the run-up, we determined that it was best to complete all these applications online. So there was all electronic submittals, no paper applications. To this day, we still have a couple hiccups in terms of people wanting to submit paper, but it actually allowed us to pivot very easily from the digital realm to virtual inspections as we went into COVID lockdown, as well as other COVID regulations throughout 2020 and continuing on to this year. Next. So as a part of this program implementation, we received approximately 157 applications. Some of these applications were denied. The biggest reason why we denied applications was because they simply applied for the wrong application. So most folks did not understand that a non-owner occupied meant they weren't there overnight for the duration of the stay, whereas the owner occupied is. So we basically rejected that application, allowed the folks to reapply, and they had their paperwork ready to go. Other instances, we discovered CC&R issues. So as a part of our ordinance, we do have to look into CC&Rs to determine that those are they are allowed in certain neighborhoods. And then finally, there was some illegal construction. So into the run-up, we made it very loud and clear that we would be checking all of our street files and building files to ensure that no unpermitted work was completed. And so on a couple of instances, we did have some unpermitted work to which the owners quickly obtained permits for and subsequently got STR permits. So as of today, there are 110 permits that are issued. 89 of those 110 are for non-owner occupied units. There was a split that was created as a part of the initial ordinance. 60 non-owner occupied permits were located in the what we consider the non-coastal zone. On your screen, it's pretty much every single area to the east of that yellow line is considered the non-coastal zone. Since we are a coastal community, we have to thread the line in terms of providing for visiting service commercials. So we included 40 permits in the coastal zone. And based on this ordinance itself, this was one of the first ordinances that went to Coastal Commission, to which we got a rounding of applause from the commission for delicating balance the need for visitor serving amenities while at the same time neighborhood preservation. Next. So what most people do with once they get the permit is they list their properties on the internet via websites such as Airbnb, VRBO, and other internet websites. Those are the big ones. These houses essentially act as little lodging units. So imagine just hotels littered all throughout the community. So they are required to collect taxes per night, per stay. Those are TOT and TDM taxes, approximately 12% per night for a TOT or transit occupancy tax. And 1.5% goes to the county for the tourism district management district. Taxes are handled by our third-party vendor host compliance. So what that means is we've given our permittees two options to remit taxes. The first one is the only paper application that's available to our permittees, and that's through our TOT tax. They're able to download a pre-filled PDF on our website. They can actually just put in the number of stays, and it should fill out electronically, print it, send us a check. The other way is actually doing it online, so completely paperless, going through host compliance, entering in their STR number, and then using either a check or a credit card. So these STRs have generated over $4 million in revenues for operators. So what that means is that's money that's back in the pockets of these homeowners to do various items and things as a part of their income. Because of that $4 million, we've generated over $486,000 in TOT revenues since the inception of this program. And so we consider launch date of October and started collecting TOT for November stay. So that's quite a bit of revenue that goes back into the city's general fund. Next. So as a part of this overall program for short-term rentals, we do have an enforcement arm and ensure people are playing by the book and by the rules. Since the inception of the STR program in October, and then finally as we started logging in calls, we received 127 complaints received since November up through September. So that's generally 6 complaints per month. Of those 127 complaints, 70% of those complaints were generated only by 9 short-term rental permits. So we do have a few short-term rentals that typically tend to generate a lot more comments. Sometimes it's the operator. Other times it is the neighbor who just doesn't want to live next to a short-term rental. So again, we're trying to balance the two needs together. City staff, as a part of our year one implementation, we reviewed the amount of comments that were generated, we reviewed the amount of complaints that were generated, and we went ahead and revised our administrative rules. And what the administrative rules are, essentially, it's our playbook of how we administer this ordinance. And so what we did is we revised the role of the local contact. So in order to basically, we would get complaints, but we couldn't quite pinpoint how to potentially find these complaints, or they were just so out there that we just couldn't really create a system that was intended by the council, which was a 3 strikes, you're out rule. So as a part of this administrative rules revision, we clarified our role of the local contact. And so what that means was, as a part of any new permit application, city staff would contact the local contact, ensure that that person indeed understood the rules in terms of being available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to hear any complaints, and then subsequently remedy those complaints in 30 minutes, either by contacting the renters of the short-term rental. And then they have 2 options. They can either call back into host compliance, notifying them that that is completed. And the final one is we actually require them to email city staff within 24 hours. If this is not followed, we issue 1 warning. And then from there, we cite as required. So based on this admin rules change that we've implemented, we've greatly cut down on the number of calls generated specifically by our 9 STRs, but also we're in better communication with our local contacts. So typically on the weekend, if there is a complaint, a great example was there was a complaint sitting there this Saturday. Our code compliance officer ended up getting an email within that 24-hour time frame, noting that there was loud music. However, it was during the day, and they let the renters know to turn it down. That's how we want this system to work, is we really want our local contacts to be the bad person and not necessarily police department, at least let our neighbors know that they are heard and we are listening. Next slide. So as a part of this implementation, we did come across some items that, again, we wanted to use as a check-in. As much as we feel at the city staff that this has been a very successful effort in implementing something that the council has given to us, there are some larger, bigger ticket items that we do need the city council to weigh in on. One of the items is first our short-term rental permits for multifamily residential buildings. The original ordinance nor our administrative rules did not define if multifamily buildings could be issued more than 1 permit. What's on your screen right now is actually a existing apartment building with 4 total units inside of it with 4 STR permits. We do have this issue at 5 locations within the city with 15 permits being issued. With the underlying owners. So the owner owns the entire building. They have multiple STR permits, which essentially creates de facto hotels within our neighborhood. Staff had amended these administrative rules to limit the number of short-term rental permits to 1 per multifamily building starting August 1st. However, we do need direction for 1 to solidify that that is the correct call, that is the intention of city staff to limit the number of permits for these multifamily buildings. So again, this is a delicate balance between neighborhood preservation, existing housing stock, specifically our rental housing stock. We all know we're in a housing crisis, so it is a delicate balance that we have to live by. And then finally, what to do with the existing multifamily permit holders? Currently, our permits are renewed starting July 1st. There's a renewal period, July 1st through July 31st. So one way the council could direct staff is to extinguish all but 1 of the permits per building. Another way is the council could direct staff to grandfather these permits in, or essentially create these permits as existing non-conforming. So essentially means that the owner would need to continue to remit their TOT and they can continue to operate, But once the permit is not renewed, that permit goes away and goes back into the permit bank. Next slide. Another issue that is propped up is multiple units with owner occupied. This one's a little, in the staff report, could have been a little bit harder to decipher. So hopefully I'll be able to walk you through this. We do have owner occupied short-term rental permits that are issued for a maximum of one unit when there are multiple units on the property. So typically that happens when you have a single family residence with an existing granny unit or ADU. We revised our ADU ordinance back in 2020 as a part of this STR ordinance to prohibit new ADUs as of June 2019 for not being used as short-term rentals. So that's in the books, it's already going. However, we do have a new issue that has arisen since we are currently capped at issuing we have no more permits left in the non-coastal zone. So it's capped at 60, we don't have any left and we have a waiting list. So what folks are trying to or asking now to do is inquiring whether they can construct an ADU on their property and occupy the ADU and go ahead and rent the primary unit as the short-term rental. As some of you do know, accessory dwelling units, especially over the last 3 to 4 years, our ability to regulate those as a municipality has been greatly diminished by the state of California. The state has adopted a series of legislation to allow for construction of ADUs within neighborhoods by reducing setbacks, reducing the ability for pretty much a lot of things that we used to do, we can no longer do, all in the name of creating more long-term rentals. However, that is now knowing that our situation is, the question becomes, do we want to follow the intention of state legislature and pretty much prohibit this practice? Because again, the state is really clamping down and trying to really energize ADU construction for long-term rental versus short-term game, and in this instance, short-term rentals, which is just meant for vacation rentals and vacation homes. Next slide. The other big one that we've come across, particularly over the last 60 days, is the issue of inactive STR permits. In our staff report, we noted that there were 8 permit holders. We went ahead and re-reviewed that. It's actually down to 6 that have not reported any stays nor TOT since the inception of the STR program. So what that means is these folks have indeed followed the administrative rules by actually reporting each and every month as required. However, they're not reporting any stays, which means they're not reporting any TOT taxes. As a part of our ordinance, section 4.10185L, it indicates that a short-term rental may be revoked if it's not utilized within a year. Currently, as mentioned in an earlier slide, we have a wait list for our non-coastal areas. That wait list currently sits at 5. We typically generate about 1 to 2 calls a day in regards to short-term rental permits, which during the spring, that was upwards of 3 to 4 to 5 a day. Simply because of the way the housing market was. So that has tapered off as realtors have you know, visited our website and begin to understand how our short-term rental program works. Because of this, staff is seeking direction on the following. The first is to enforce the ordinance and just proceed with revocations. That's our ordinance basically allows for 1 year. These 6 STRs have again reported, but have not utilized this permit for what it's for, which is utilizing for vacation rental and generation of TOT taxes. The second option is provide a 90-day extension to report TOT or stays. So essentially gives these 6 permit holders 90 days to actually get a stay, or finally provide a specified time extension. So what that means is there are a couple permit holders. What they have asked for is additional time because of COVID. So that is something you should probably weigh in on in terms of this item. And then finally, we do need a direction on minimum stays within the 1 year period. So what that means is, do we want to establish amount of 1 stay per year or 2 stays per year or 1 per quarter for that time period that allows all STR permit or all permit holders to be on the same equal footing, knowing that they have to use their permit or they will lose it. Next slide. Finally, we get to the STR permit cap. Again, our ordinance did establish a non-owner occupied cap at 100 units, 40 in the coastal zone, 60 in the non-coastal zone. It does balance in visitors' access and long-term rental housing. At this point in time, staff does not recommend increasing that cap. We do have an additional 11 units that are available in the coastal areas, but again, the units are capped in the non-coastal zone. And so again, we'll leave that up to the council to provide direction, but again, staff is not recommending increasing that cap. Next slide. So these are the items before you this evening, and we are requesting council direction on multiple permits for multifamily residences, permits for owner-occupied with more than one unit, inactive short-term rentals, and finally, STR non-owner-occupied permit caps. And with that, I will turn it over to the council for any questions.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Castillo, for that that presentation and that update. Let's see first if there's any questions from council members for Mr. Castillo. We'll start with Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Well, thank you. First of all, excellent, excellent report. Really appreciate you bringing this to us. This was something that was very near and dear to my heart, so I thank you very much for this. I do have a couple of questions. I don't know. I went through this a number of times, so I can't say they're going to be in any order. So, let's see, page two. Where there's a discussion regarding the city had, I guess, received some comments from permit holders regarding making a payment at City Hall of the TOT, because I guess they couldn't make it online, and they would have preferred that the TOT was collected directly from the platform operators. Is that the same process done in other cities?
So I believe you're asking a question of whether or not the platform operators such as Airbnb and VRBO collect the taxes for them. Yes, there are in unincorporated San Luis Obispo County and the city of San Luis, as well as Morro Bay, Airbnb and VRBO, they collect the taxes for the user. However, they just collect the taxes and cut the city one large check. So there is no checks and balances. That's sort of the unfair part. We don't know where they're located. We don't know how they're operating. We can't regulate them. We just get a check.
I see.
So that's why we went ahead and gone with the model of host compliance to go ahead and submit those taxes either through paper or through the website. And the website actually just walks you through how to do it. What that means is it basically you enter in the numbers of stays, you enter in how much they are, and it calculates the tax for you automatically.
Okay, but it's still all done online. I mean, it's all done. It's okay. I get it. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Now, regarding really struck me. The 70% complaints associated with the 9 person. So has that been pretty much resolved with those 9 properties?
It has, since we went ahead and made this change. One of them, it just so happened, they didn't renew. So that was the bulk of the 70% was the one. and it was, it borderlined into a neighbor dispute. But with that being said, for the most part, the other ones, they are resolving very quickly. They get the call, there's a complaint, and then they went ahead, they do what they need to do to resolve that complaint in enough time.
Very good. I mean, sometimes, you know, you just can't help who your neighbors are. So that's, we all know that. And, you know, they're just not going to be happy having that kind of activity next door to them. But as long as they comply with the rules and so on. Okay, very good. Then on page 4, there is a reference to an illegal STRs with over 50 stays, and a discussion about going to take appropriate action. Now, what would that possibly be?
So, with these STRs that are really tough to identify, on a couple occasions we have been able to identify them after long searching through the city, working with code compliance. On these other ones, it's really just needed to continue to reach out with hosts to finally identify them. And once they are sent a letter, essentially very quickly to come into compliance. So that those are what we're doing right now to really just try to find those ones that are out there that are just really tough to identify, that are currently operating outside of the permit process.
So once you do identify them, then you bring them into the permit process?
Yes. So recently we did identify one. They quickly shut down their advertisement, and they only got far as only one stay. And so that's we're still working with the property owner to resolve that.
So now what happens when we don't have any available permits?
Unfortunately, they would have to put themselves on a waiting list, which is what one of them has done.
Okay, I see. Okay, very good. I think those are my questions. I have plenty of comments. You can be sure of that. So I'll wait until that opportunity arises. Thank you very much, Mayor.
Very good. Thank you for those questions. And before I turn it over to Councilmember Robert for his questions, I'll remind folks that if you do want to comment on this item, please call in at 805-321-6639. And now I'll turn it over to Councilmember Robert for any questions that he might have.
Thank you for that report, Mr. Castillo. Quite thorough. We appreciate it. Before we started this program, the city, I imagine we had short-term rentals. And do we have any kind of idea of how many complaints we got in those situations before we had a program, Mr. Castillo?
That I do not know. To answer the first part of your question, yes, we did have short-term rentals. They went unregulated. I know from a little bit of history that we attempted to regulate those in the early 2010s, but that just never was put together. So this latest iteration was done and completed. There was public input for it, which is why you see the program that it's shaped today based on the public input that was provided as well as the council direction.
Okay. I guess the point I was trying to get to is, I've heard a lot of people, especially with people that have neighbors of short-term rentals, complaining about the short-term rentals. And my comeback to them was, you know, we've always had short-term rentals. We just didn't have a program. And now we have a program that we can control and monitor these short-term rentals and get some sanity out of them, if you will, and some response without taking up all of the administration's time and the police time. I suspect the complaints before were just through the police department. People would call and complain about it. So I didn't like the program, but the more I thought about it, the more I looked at it, I think it's a good thing for our city. Now, the city you mentioned does look at the CCNRs in the neighborhood and respects those.
Yes, so as a part of a permit application, the question is asked, do you have CCNRs, and it is required that those are uploaded. They're as a part of our mapping system. We do know of areas that have them. So when they're missing them, particularly in PUDs, we ask the question right back, where are your CCNRs? So that's typically what we do as a part of our review process.
Okay, thank you. And when you send out the notifications to the people that are 150 feet away, do you get back, let me phrase this a different way. What if someone were to complain about it? What resource do they have? Can they stop a permit, or is there just a notification that said this is going to happen, whether you like it or not, that type of situation?
It's an administrative permit, so we issue it, and then it's it's 150 feet, and we typically, what we've done is we've walked through the complaint process of how to lodge those complaints. In one instance, we really had to do handholding with a neighbor in terms of what to complain about and how to complain about it. And then subsequently, if it elevates and escalates past 11 o'clock, and it's still noisy, you call the police if there's no compliance done through host compliance and through the local contact.
Right. That, I think people need to be aware of that too, because they can complain, but if they don't complain to the right people, nothing's ever going to get done. And I've told neighbors that as well. You need to call in that host line and complain right away and do it often if it's happening often. And then they could lose their permit. I know we enforce that pretty well. Okay, I think we'll handle each subject as you're asking for direction as we go along. So that was all the questions I had. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those. And before I go to Councilmember Rushing, it looks like our city manager has some additional information to add.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. And I wanted to actually maybe take a moment and have Mr. Buckingham provide some additional information regarding the question that Councilmember Robert asked about complaints prior to the ordinance to today, because I think it is an important point for the council and the public to be aware of, as it really was a cornerstone for why we began this journey to create an ordinance and a regulated environment where there was none before. And I want to have Mr. Buckingham maybe speak to that for a moment, just to be able to provide that context.
Yes, Councilmember Robert, you are correct. In essence, we did not have an ordinance, therefore we had no regulations for short-term rentals, but they were allowed. So complaints received were very difficult to respond to, other than something that would be a violation of the police, a police violation, or there were some underlying things like trash cans that we might have had codes that existed for previously. But there was no regulation over the number of people that could stay, the number of guests that could also visit, and there was no TOT collection. So the whole reason the council, after deliberating on whether an ordinance should move forward, was very much related to the fact we had no regulation, and the only way to regulate and create good players, if you will, good neighbors, was through the adoption of an ordinance. And I can tell you there were multiple public hearings and input from the council and the community. And the council at the time ultimately decided that this was a balance, but a necessary requirement to move forward so we could regulate and protect our neighborhoods.
Thank you, Mr. Buckingham. I knew at first, because I was involved when these all things started as just a citizen, wasn't on the council at the time, but at first I was informed. I didn't like the idea, but the more I investigated, the more I learned about them, the more I understood them, I felt it was a good thing for our city. It gives, like you say, a balance. It also gives us revenue to help create a sane neighborhood, because before there was just people just doing what they want, the Wild West, if you will, and just there was nothing other than the police, calling the police and complaining about that, but, you know, what happens then. So, yeah, it's a good thing, I believe, at this point. And I like the fact that we're keeping the permits down to a minimum. You don't want to overwhelm the city. So, great. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those questions and the blending of those into comments. And we'll have some more of those after public comment as well. So, Councilmember Rushing, any questions?
I have no questions. Many comments, but those will come later.
Very good. I'm sure that we'll all have some comments as well. So I guess the single question I have for Mr. Castillo is, has there been, under the multifamily multiple permit STRs, in the event that that four-unit apartment complex, would we go back down? Is the recommendation of staff to go back down to one for that entire four-unit complex, or would there be something else that could be a consideration?
Again, this is a complete council call. And the two easiest options are one, we would amend the ordinance, and basically we would allow just for one to be renewed, and the other three would just go back into the pool. The other one would be to allow for this to become existing non-conforming use. So what that means is they're allowed to renew. They're allowed to continue to generate TOT. They're allowed to continue to advertise as long as they're, you know, paying their permit license fee and there are no, you know, no issues, et cetera. And they would continue until such time as they decide to no longer renew.
Okay. Very good. Quick follow-up on that. Is there a restriction in our code that they would have to be individual users, or could four of the same family basically rent the entire complex?
At this time, we do what's called only whole host or whole house rental. So I know there's been many inquiries about splitting. If they have, if a homeowner has three bedrooms, could they rent each individual room to three individual renters? Our administrative rules don't allow that right now. However, there's nothing to say that there could be a coordinated effort using these multifamily ones as an example, where one family does rent one, another family rents another one, and another family rents the same one. So there could be a coordinated effort, but nothing in our rules that would dictate the such from not happening.
Gotcha. Definitely appreciate that. And one, apologize, one other follow-up. Let's say, for instance, technically the same person owns all four apartment complexes. And what happens if that person put it in, let's say, their wife's name, or someone else has a different ownership? Would that then allow them to do a subsequent STR, or would tonight's action potentially say apartment complexes, multifamily houses, we go from one only for those four, unless they're if they're the same ownership? But if they're different ownerships, would we have multiple options for each of those multifamily units?
Right.
Perhaps we'll defer to Mr. Buckingham and see if he wants to respond to that first.
Yeah, it's a great question. I just wanted to chime in that the problem that staff would have if someone sells it to another relative in the family is we have ownership information. But if that ownership information is listed differently and we have trusts and we have other things, it would become very difficult for the staff to be able to interpret that. So I would not, depending on the council's direction, we don't want anybody to circumvent this, but I think we would have to stick to the facts that if the ownership is different, then we would issue them a short-term rental permit.
Okay, so if we had a four-unit apartment complex that had four different owners, there could be four STRs in that complex.
That's correct.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, great. I appreciate that confirmation. And just by a show of unmuting, if any questions were generated by or new questions by council after our discussion here, looks like Mayor Pro Tem Bright, you've unmuted, so you had another question.
So then we're just talking about properties owned by the same owner in the same building or on the same property, basically.
That's correct. So like going back to that image at 1501 Atlantic, one owner, that's it, but they just have four permits. So
it's okay.
Technically not a condo, it's one owner for four units.
So then we're saying about preventing having a hotel, let's say, or whatever, having a hotel in a residential area, we really wouldn't be preventing such a thing. Because if there's four different owners of a fourplex and they all decide to have a short-term rental in that fourplex, we would not be preventing a hotel in a residential area, would we?
So Councilmember Bright, probably just very unlikely that would occur, but this is also the reason for having a cap and a maximum number, so that we have other ways to prevent that. And I think if you looked at the current map that was provided in the staff report, you'd see, it's good news that these short-term rentals are somewhat dispersed across the city. We don't have a large over-concentration in one area. So while technically that's not likely, it's not impossible to occur at this point.
Okay, so I just missed that part that we're talking about one owner. Okay. I just missed that part. Okay, very good. I get it now. Thank you very much for the clarification. Thank you, Mayor, for delving a little bit deeper into that.
Certainly.
Appreciate it.
Very good. And before we go to Councilmember Roberts, I saw that our city attorney had unmuted his mic and wasn't sure if he wanted to add something to the conversation.
Maybe.
Maybe this will confuse things even more. Apartment complexes are not single family residences. It's on one lot. So can you have multiple owners? Yes, but they'll hold tenancy in common, or they'll hold tenancy as one lot. So a group of owners, there could be 20 of them, but it's one lot and a group of owners that own all of that. If you limit that four-unit apartment complex, multifamily, to one, then theoretically they would all be limited to one. If you have four units with four separate owners, then they have to own it, or it has to be a complex that allows multiple ownership. Apartments typically would not. Condos would. Condominiums are separate ownership and airspace on a single lot. A fourplex could be owned theoretically by four different people if they sit on separate lots. So it depends on the circumstances, but theoretically, if we're talking an apartment complex, you're not going to have four separate owners of four separate units. You're going to have possibly four owners of a lot with four apartments on it. So we'd have to go through the dynamics of each one of these developments and determine how your limitation would apply to that development. Does that make sense?
I believe it does. Thank you for that clarification. So next I'll turn to Councilmember Robert for his subsequent questions.
Yeah, I was with Mayor Pro Tem Wright as well, to try to avoid the hotel situation. But in thinking about it, in condominiums, I would say 9 out of 10 CC&Rs do not allow short-term rentals. They avoid that because these people that buy these condos are typically people that this is their home, and they don't want things like that happening in their condos. So I don't think we have a situation where they turn them into hotels in condos. So I agree with you.
Gotcha. So trying to make sure we stay towards questions here at the moment. So Councilmember Rushing.
Never. I'll get back okay. to
Perhaps comments after public comments. So let's see. So let's open up public comment on this item. So please do so by calling in at 805-321-6639. And let's turn to our city clerk and see who we have on the line for public comment on this item.
Yes, we have Diane Colbert. I didn't say your name bad.
Yeah.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity as a property owner to speak at your meeting. And I appreciate that you're taking time out to look at this situation. I know it's not an easy one. But I would like to speak as a property owner of one of the multiple units that you're addressing tonight. So part of my feedback is just to give you a perspective as someone who has used investment funds and used the current situation to make certain decisions for those investment funds. I am a self-employed person as part of a self-employed household. So it is our responsibility to plan for our own future and our retirement income. And this particular investment represents part of that picture for us. So it's a big consideration. And that's why I appreciate the opportunity to give you my viewpoint on this. We went into this agreement with the city and followed all the guidelines for applying and thought your process was stellar, and the people you had represent the process, we thought were very professional, and we really appreciate that, my family and I. It was a pleasure working with them, and they represented the city well. We thought we had done everything that was expected of us through that process. So changing this ordinance would have a fairly significant impact on those decisions made during that time. And again, the investments that were made to upgrade the property, we put a substantial amount of funds in upgrading the property to improve it, in our opinion. And the initial implementation of the ordinance seemed like a good investment for this particular time for us. So any change to the ordinance, which would exclude certain properties such as ours, it would definitely have a substantial impact on our financial viability and the investment that we've decided to participate in there in Grover Beach. I believe for this particular property that I own, there was an out-of-town owner, and it was not maintained very well. I, on the other hand, I live 10 minutes away, and I'm very invested in the community and want to see forward progress, want to do what I can to improve the neighborhoods. We feel like we've been a good neighbor. As far as we know, there have been no complaints or negative feedback from any neighboring properties. We felt like we have followed the guidelines set forth by the city to the T and are open to suggestions. So based on that information, we would request maintaining the current agreements, especially with the consideration that the possibility of extinguishing those agreements would happen in even under 1 year's time. That does seem a little unfair. I would request that the current approved units would be grandfathered in as long as we follow the rules and pay the TOT taxes, which up until now we have done so. So thank you so much for hearing my feedback. And that's just one perspective of a property owner.
Very good. I definitely appreciate those comments. So let's turn to our city clerk and see if there's any other members of the public on the line for this item.
We have Krista Jeffries.
Good evening, Ms. Jeffries.
Good evening, council members. Thank you for inviting public comment. I don't think it's going to come as any surprise to any of the council members that I would, I look at a four-unit complex and all of them becoming short-term rentals as a loss for the community, for the people who live here long-term. I understand that the owner went into the agreement under the understanding that this was going to be just fine. And I think changing that relatively soon afterwards probably encourages a little bit of bad will on the part of the property owner. So I'm kind of torn between all of this. My gut instinct is to say, to let the short-term rentals continue for a certain period of time and then allow three of them to expire. And I think that would give the property owner time to plan. There are other options if the property owner has, you know, ways of investing and things like that, then dealing with real estate means changes in the laws and changes in tenant protections and changes in production and all of those things. That's part and parcel of being a property owner and using it as an income source. So I believe in the property owner's ability to deal with those, but it will take time. So I think allowing three of those to elapse after a certain period of time while allowing her to keep one of them would be just fine. On the issue of ADUs and whether you can use the main house as a rental unit while the owner lives in the ADU, my first instinct was, well, it would make it a lot easier for families like mine who can't really afford hotel rooms to get their kids to sleep to take those kinds of trips. But at the same time, I know that we have a housing shortage. So in the spirit of the law, I think it doesn't really make any sense to gain one unit and then make it become a vacation rental, because that's the same thing that would happen if we were allowing ADUs to be used for short-term rentals. So thank you so much for taking such care for this issue. I know it's a delicate balance and we want the tourism. I've got no problem with tourists at all. I grew up in a tourist city. But I know that we have to balance the needs of the people who are already, you know, there's dozens of people applying for every unit that comes open. So thank you for your careful attention to this matter, and I look forward to your decision. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for that input. Let's check back in with the city clerk for see if anyone else has joined us for public comment on this item.
Yes, we have Elizabeth Summers.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the council. I am a holder of one of the short-term rental permits, and I've really appreciated the opportunity to do that in our city. I again, like the person who spoke previously, really felt that your process was incredibly well done, and Mr. Castillo was just great to work with.
and the process went really well. I've had no issues at all with my rental unit, and we've had quite a few rentals. I talked to my neighbors, and they've had no issues. They haven't heard anything from my renters. And one of the reasons I think that it has gone really well is that I hired a professional property manager to screen potential renters, and she is doing a fabulous job of managing it. One of the glitches for me was that I hired a professional property manager, and she lives 35 minutes away. And so she can't be my emergency contact because your rules are 30 minutes. She's an incredibly responsive and professional person, and I would just ask you to consider situational approval for emergency contact rules, especially if you have a property that has a history of no complaints and compliance and cooperation with the city. I would just ask you to consider extending those on a case-by-case basis, if not expanding the contact time beyond 30 minutes. So that's just my question, and thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those comments. So let's check you back in, see if anyone else has joined us for this item.
No, we have no other callers on the line.
Very good. Thank you very much. I will go ahead and close public comment on this item, bring it back to the council for discussion. And let's check in just real briefly with either Mr. Castillo or Mr. Buckingham, see if there are any questions that needed to be addressed. Maybe one from Ms. Summers was the 35 minutes for the property, for distance from the property. So obviously we don't want anyone to speed and break the speed laws while traveling to that. But is there is it required that the person lives within or travels within 30 minutes of the property, or is it just a matter of contact ability?
It is officially set up in our administrative rules. It's a 30-minute travel time, and it's actually explained in the administrative rules that we select a Saturday night at 9 o'clock. We pop in the address of the short-term rental local contact to the actual STR, and it gives you a time frame if it's within that 30-minute time frame. And sometimes if it bumps out to 32 minutes, we're typically okay with it. But that's how we determine it. So it's an algorithm of Google that does it for us. So I will leave it up to the council to extend that, but the 30 minutes does seem to work pretty well. And the reason being is we do want a very speedy response of our local contact.
Very good. Thank you. So, Mr. Buckingham, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I will just reiterate the last point Mr. Castillo made was, sure, that the council could change that time. It is actually codified, so it would also require a code amendment. But I think the whole reasoning, again, was that if a local contact person had to show up because they had to evict a neighbor or a renter because of an issue, the whole point is, what's a reasonable amount of time that someone should have to deal with the issue that's ongoing before someone can arrive? So we'll welcome council input on that one.
Very good. Appreciate that. So was there other questions? Let's see. And just to confirm, the way the staff report is recommending at this point is that ADUs not be allowed for newly constructed ADUs. There's a small window of ADU construction that would be allowed for STRs. Is that correct? And was prior to 2019?
Right, prior to 2019, and we do have three permit holders that currently have that under. But again, it's more of trying to prevent future ADU construction that is going to long-term rentals. That's what the state wants. And kind of sidestepping this owner-occupied versus non-owner-occupied issue.
Gotcha. Okay. Very good. And as we get into the conversation, this question just popped into my brain as well, is from a compliance standpoint, we have not had a number of short-term rental violations, correct? So at this point, we haven't collected any revenue from short-term rental violations. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that clarification. Anything else from the public comment that either of you would like to add to the discussion? Seeing neither of you unmute, I'll take that as a no, and I'll bring it back to the council for discussion and consideration. So let's start by some general comments, and then we'll kind of see if we get a consensus on what staff is looking for this evening. So I'll start with Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Okay. Well, I think that I might just be, I think I would probably be more suited to, if you want to just go down the list of the items that staff is looking for, and because I've pretty much arranged my comments in that fashion. So I'd be happy to let my colleagues go forward with their general comments. And then if you just want to come back to me when you're ready to go forward in that direction, I'll be ready. Okay.
Sounds good. Very good. Then perhaps let me just by show of consensus or non-unmuting yourselves, if you agree, we'll just kind of go point by point. Otherwise, if you have some general comments, go ahead and unmute yourself. But seeing that no one unmute themselves, I agree with Councilmember Mayor Pro Tem Bright. Let's start with some of the easier ones first, and either Mr. Castile or Mr. Buckingham, let me make. Tell me if I miss one. One of the questions that you had for us tonight was to whether how to enforce the ordinance and proceed with the revocation process, whether if there was an unused permit, if that was to be 12 months as a hard stop, or if we wanted to add a 90-day extension to that. Let's start with that one. So Councilmember Mayor Pro Tem Bright, did you want to start with our revocation potential or extension of SDR permits?
Well, my thoughts are, I think that we should notify them that they're in violation, proceed with the revocation process, and let them go from there. If they want to ask for some sort of a if they want to ask for some kind of an extension, or if they have some sort of reason why they feel like there shouldn't be a revocation of their permit, then they can say so. Otherwise, I think we just need to get on with it, because there are people who are in the wings waiting, and that's my opinion on it.
Okay. And perhaps a question there is, do you think 90 days is an adequate time if we were to grant that extension upon notification?
I think that's plenty of time.
Okay, very good. So let me go to Councilmember Rushing, see if that any comments that you want to add to that.
No, I actually really like that in general. I mean, last year was a little bit crazy for a lot of people, and I've seen some commentary from our short-term renters that were like, you know, we just didn't feel comfortable having people in the house during COVID for the last year. So having a more gentle touch for the foreseeable future is not a bad thing. So I think a 90-day buffer should be sufficient.
Very good. Councilmember Robert.
I agree. 90-day buffer would be good, but are we going to keep it at 90 days? In other words, or are you asking us, should we make some kind of requirement? Perhaps they at least rent it once a month? There is no requirement, as I understand right now. Is that correct?
And actually, that was going to be my next item. So I figured we would start with the kind of the revocation or extension of a permit that's been unused. Okay, so it sounds like we've got consensus, because I'm in agreement as well, for extending non-active permits for an additional 90 days with obviously proper notification and a request for justification on the permit holders' parts. So now to Councilmember Robert, his next item, which was the number of stays per month, and I'll let you start, sir, with your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that someone that applies for a short-term rental would want to probably rent it out every weekend, I would imagine, because they want to generate revenue. And so I would think we should have a requirement of once a month, because the people are waiting to get these permits and they want to do this, and there are people just sitting on the permits not getting anything with them. I don't quite understand that. Maybe there's something I'm just not seeing there. But COVID was definitely a problem, as Councilmember Rushing said. I don't know that I would want anyone staying that close and me have to go clean up or hire someone to clean the place up. So I'm thinking once a month. I don't know if that's too much. What does everyone else believe? Thank you.
And perhaps maybe just a quick question for that, just to make sure we're all on the same page as we have the discussion. Would that be a once per month average, or a once per month requirement? So if we said basically a minimum of 12 times a year, but you could have
four in 1 month. Yeah,
four maybe. In 1 month.
Okay. Yeah.
So it sounds like you'd be open to either scenario of at least there's one per month. Okay, gotcha. So Councilmember Rushing, any questions, comments, input?
So typically we consider a stay a non-interrupted moment in time too, right? So, you know, if you're in the home for 5 days, that is a stay. If you're there for a week, it's a stay. If you're there for a day, it's a stay. We live in our weather is not always the same. Let's say that. So at the very least, we would need to figure out some way of figuring out some sort of average throughout it, like a once per month kind of thing, because I personally know there's short-term rentals in my neighborhood, and there's not a whole lot of them that are occupied in late January. It's just like, it just doesn't happen. You know, just to keep people honest and with the spirit of what we're trying to do here, which is to make sure that people can use their property effectively, but at the same time, making sure that we have housing available for our residents for long-term rentals. I would say that a quarterly kind of a scenario would be probably acceptable to me personally. So if there was just like four stays per year, just making sure that you're ticking through the boxes, because I know that like maybe not everybody is actively like trying to fill their short-term rental constantly, but I do want to make sure that like that housing is actually being at least used and not just lying dormant when it could actually be used for somebody to be living in. So those are my 5 cents.
Maybe a quick question for Mr. Castile or Mr. Buckingham based upon Mr. Rushing's suggestion. Do we have a ability to know what our average stay length is?
Unfortunately, no, because as mentioned by Councilmember Rushing, a stay is considered a stay, whether it's 1 day, 2 days, 5 days. As mentioned by Councilmember Rushing, we do have permit holders. As a matter of fact, I just did an inspection for one today, was one of our last ones, that basically they intend on utilizing it when they go on vacation. So it's a family that occupies it for the majority of the year, but for the moments that they go on vacation during the spring and summer, they plan on utilizing that as a rental. We have others that are in the system that I know that they're living there during the summer to get away from the valley heat. So that, you know, they're running the opposite, and then they rent it out during the winter. So there's quite a big spectrum. And then there are others that it is an every single weekend maximum amount of profit as possible, because they're just utilizing it for income, as mentioned by one of our callers. So it's a range. That's probably much the best answer I can give you.
And so a stay can be up to 29 days, basically, right? Anything after 30 days becomes a kind of a rental of the property. Is that correct?
A 30 days. So at day 31, it's no longer a short-term rental.
Okay, very good. So, okay. Okay, good. Mr. Buckingham?
Nothing to add.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright?
So then, I'm thinking maybe we shouldn't be talking about stays, particularly if we're talking about people who are planning to rent their home during the summer. You know, they may just have somebody who, one person who comes and stays for 2 months. You know, that could be, well, I guess that wouldn't work because that'd be 60 days. So that wouldn't work. But it could be two stays or three stays. You know, people are coming and staying for 3 weeks at a time. But, you know, that's going to be, say, 60 days or whatever. I don't know. But I don't know how those numbers actually, you know, how they actually apply. But I hope you get my drift. So maybe we need to talk about days rather than stays. That brings up whole other that's a whole other issue than stays. So,
and especially since, as Mr. Castillo mentioned, we don't really have a way to track days.
No, we don't. Stays. Right.
So, Mr. Castillo.
Actually, I Matters of Wonder Technology, I can actually look at it. We do track nights occupied, so it is considered evenings occupied. It's on the enforcement end that tracks stays, which is why we are able to ping our permittees, say, hey, you didn't pay because you have four stays, but you're only showing one. So we do track nights occupied.
Okay.
So that does allow us to have that conversation, though. Okay.
So maybe we should think about that other than number of stays, because you may just have three people stay during the summer and it ends up being 20 days or something. I don't know. Does that make sense?
I believe it does. So Councilmember Robert, you had put your hand up. Did you want to add
I was just going to add that I'm sure we can track the days because we know how often they use it through the TOT. So maybe it should be connected to the TOT they generate per year and not for stays. So they maybe need to have a minimum TOT in order for the permit to exist and continue. That's all I was going to say. Thank you.
Okay. So perhaps turn it back to Mr. Castillo. Mr. Buckingham, are you aware of other communities that have a requirement for either a number of stays or minimum TOT threshold that we could kind of use as a template?
Not off the top of my head. I know minimum TOT is a tough one because that one, it means that city staff needs to be tracking how much each person charges per night. It adds an enormous amount of city staff time. Whereas number of days is a different story. We can track that as a part of the reporting program, even if it were to equate out to 1 week in a month. So, you know, that's approximately 24 nights occupied. That's just an example, just throwing it out there. So, those are sort of the type of frames that you want to build in for staff to easily implement a requirement that provides a minimum amount of stays.
Understood. So perhaps let me throw out an option and see if it gets any traction. Is ultimately the program to be a success is people need to be using the short-term rentals. If people aren't using those, the city's not generating any TOT. And so perhaps in a quarter, if the city doesn't get any TOT received from a particular STR permittee, then we send a notice, or they're required to provide us with a reason why they haven't been utilizing their STR. And if they give a valid reason, then that's acceptable. And they say our plan to use it for the rest of the year is we will have STRs. So is that a viable option for staff to basically, I know we're probably adding a little bit of confusion to it, but it's like if someone basically represents that they're going to use it but haven't done it on a quarter, they have to notify us. And if they haven't used it in 6 months, I go back to Mr. Castillo's example where someone from the valley wants to use it during use their house during the course of the heat, but may not rent it out until December, January, in which case there's 10 months out of the year that they're not going to be generating TOT. And I don't think we want to necessarily penalize someone for that, but obviously it's not the best and highest use of the short-term rental program. So thoughts on that, Mr. Buckingham?
From a staff perspective, because of the different situations that exist and somebody may only rent it out for 3 months in a 12-month period, I think it would be easier for staff to look at it in a year-round perspective. But with that said, the real issue, as the council is discussing, is we want people that have short-term rental permits to use their short-term their homes as short-term rentals and not have one stay or one night a year just to keep a permit valid because they're going to retire in 5 years and they really want to have an STR when they retire, but they don't want it today. And this wouldn't be an issue except that we're at our limit of 60 in the non-coastal zone area. So the policy decision for the council is, you know, what's a reasonable amount of nights? I agree stays may become more complicated. What's the number of nights in a period? But I think from staff, rather than checking in on a quarterly basis, we and someone having a legitimate excuse versus what if the excuse didn't seem legitimate, it would be difficult for staff to use their, I would prefer staff as not having to use their discretion to determine if that was a valid reason for not operating. So,
okay. Councilmember Roberts.
I just so I understand, when we started this, I thought, Mr. Castillo, that you said that we had an option of the TOT. We could have collected it from the management company and sent us one bulk check. Or did you not say that each individual account has to go online to our website and enter their amount that stays and then figures out the TOT for them? Did I misunderstand that?
Yeah, that is a misunderstanding. So one of the chief comments from our operators is why doesn't Airbnb or VRBO collect the tax for them rather than them having to compute it on their own? And so again, the rationale was because they just provide one large check to the city, but no checks and balances, doesn't tell us any information of who's staying what, where they're staying, and where they're located. It's just one check.
Right. Isn't that what I just said? I just said that how do we get RTOT? We get it from the website, from the people going on and calculating it?
The individual users calculate it instead of Airbnb calculating it for them and Airbnb turning around and giving the city money. Right. Those are the two differences of the two.
And that's how I understood it. That each account we have the access to their account because they're paying us on whatever period of basis they pay the TOT. Is that correct?
Well, we don't have access to their account. They report. So it's on the honor system, essentially. However,
we get a check from that property.
From that individual person, yes.
Yeah, for TOT. Right. Okay, so I don't understand why you said it would take too much staff time to figure out how much TOT each person is paying. And we know it already. That's where I'm confused.
I think perhaps what Mr. Buckingham was saying is I think we as a city know when someone pays us TOT, but if we were to identify a stay as a requirement for that. So I think that's where he was trying to get away from.
No, I understand that. That's why we got away from that. We don't want to figure out a stay because that'd take too much time. Maybe that's where I misunderstood Mr. Castillo's. But the TOT, we know what the amount is for each person. Just click on their account and see what they pay for the year, correct?
It's a yes and no question because I really don't want to get the weeds of this, but a TOT can flux. That's probably the best way. Airbnb provides tools that if a owner decides to let Airbnb dictate the price, then some weekends become higher, some weekends become lower, and it's not just a one set price. So is it based on a percentage of TOT that's brought in? Is it based on one single set amount?
Excuse me, Mr. Castillo. I'm just saying that at the end of the year, we know how much each property pays in TOTs. Is that correct?
We can look back and see how much it's generated.
I'm not saying per night, per stay. I'm just saying at the end of the year, if they didn't generate whatever their price is, $300 in TOTs, and they shouldn't have a permit. That's all. I'm just thinking that's a better way just to tell whether or not they're using their permit.
Okay. So let me come back to kind of an idea here, and I'll let Mr. Bronson kind of weigh in just a moment. Is ultimately we want to make sure that our short-term rentals are being utilized, and so I think if we get if we come, maybe perhaps I got us down too much into the weeds. So Councilmember Robert had a discussion of once per month. Mr. Rushing had four times per year, and so perhaps if we get back to just a kind of an activity discussion, I'll turn to Mr. Bronson and see if that's where his thoughts were going. It's like if we generate a floor of minimum usage.
Exactly, Mr. Mayor. I guess on a broader level, I'll just say that this is a rich conversation around an important policy area that we haven't discussed in over 2 years. So I appreciate the council's deliberation. This is a new area for us, and I appreciate your deliberation on this and the three other topics that we'll be getting to once we talk about inactive permits. And I guess from the staff perspective, building from Mr. Buckingham's comments, I agree that narrowing down to days or the nights is better than the stays, given the conversation. And we think that's a better approach than the TOT registry because nights are more easily tracked. And so staff would suggest, just for council's consideration, perhaps looking at 12 minimum over the course of a year. That way, it's not tied into a certain month, a certain quarter, but it is tied into an annual amount, and somebody can have a floor of 12 and then be able to track that more readily at the staff level so that we get the activity we need in these permits for our community.
So let me ask a question just to clarify, and that's basically 12 nights per year, not 12 stays per year.
That's correct, 12 nights per year,
a minimum. Very good. Minimum. Okay, so I saw a thumbs up from Councilmember Rushing. So, but I see Mayor Pro Tem Bright unmuted. So let's go to her for questions, comments.
Well, I like that idea. I was heading in a different direction. I was thinking TOT total, but I think that's good by me. I'm good with it. 12 nights total a year. That could be taken care of in 1, 2, 3 stays, and you're done. I think it sounds good to me.
Very good. Next, I'll turn back to Councilmember Roberts, see if he has comments on that.
No, I agree. I'll agree with that. I just need to be fair for everyone so that everyone has 12 nights, not stays. Okay.
Very good. So I think we've got consensus on 12 nights or days per year. Doesn't need to be consecutive. Doesn't need to, we're basically just going to do that 12 nights per year. So perhaps we can add a little bit of staff direction, just to say if we find in a year from now that this is either working great, wonderful. If it's not working, then perhaps we have staff revisit that internally and see if there's adjustments that need to be made. Everybody okay with that? Cool. Okay, very good. Great. So good topic on that one. So let's go to, before we get to the multifamily housing, let's go to the ADU discussion and see if we've got consensus on staff's recommendation to continue with the I guess it would be the prohibition of a use of ADUs unless already grandfathered in. So future ADUs are not available to create an STR on a property. Any comments on that? We'll start with Councilmember Rushing since he's unmuted.
So it's just the ADUs, and we're also talking about owners building ADUs and then moving into the main building at the same time too, right?
Correct. Yes.
Okay, perfect. I think that definitely skirts the spirit of what we're trying to do with ADUs. So I would definitely agree with that recommendation on that. Thank you.
Very good. Next, we'll go to Councilmember Roberts.
Well, are we going to grandfather in the ADUs that are existing, say that that's okay if they have a permit now, and then not issue any permits to the new ADUs, as Councilman Rushing said?
That is correct. Again, the ordinance actually created a specific date where you're grandfathered in. There's only three in the entire city.
Yeah.
And so we would maintain those. Okay. So Councilmember Robert is consensus. Mayor Pro Tem Bright?
Yes, I agree. We need to prohibit ADUs as being built so that STRs can be created, whether it be the ADU or the original house. It certainly defeats our long-term rental solution that we're trying to solve. So, absolutely.
Very good. So we've got consensus on those three items so far. So before we tackle the multifamily question, Mr. Castillo and Mr. Buckingham, have I missed any of the other topics that you need from us tonight?
One more topic outside of the multifamily is the cap. And again, we are recommending not to increase the cap. So this might be an easier discussion.
Very good. By a show of thumbs, anybody or everybody want to keep the caps as they are? Okay, so it looks like we'll keep the caps as they are currently. So that takes us to our multifamily discussion. So who wants to start that? So I'll go ahead and start with Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Well, I thought I knew where I was going with this until we heard from Diane. I'm not sure I caught her last name, Olbert-Hurt, I think. But so I can understand her concern, absolutely. So I just don't know. I do like Krista Jeffries' idea, where maybe we do allow a grandfathering idea of maybe a certain period of time, where if you have multiple units in one development, where they do eventually drop off. So I think that would be my preference. I understand where she's going with the fact that she hasn't had any complaints and that sort of thing, but we truly do not want to have hotels in our residential areas. And unfortunately, we do end up with these unexpected and unintended consequences when we initiate these types of programs and policies, and this is what happens. So certainly I do not want to bring any kind of hardship on anyone. It certainly isn't intended and isn't something that we want to do. So I would, hopefully we can, you know, we can accommodate those folks so that it isn't a financial hardship on them. But I do know that it can be an issue, and it is an issue to some people whereby they are living next to a motel, basically. So that would be my opinion. And I'd like to see if we can maybe work towards something like that where it would be an equitable solution for everyone. Thank you.
Very good. Let me turn to Mr. Buckingham, because he may want to add something to the conversation based upon the Mayor Pro Tem's
input. Yeah, real quickly, I'll help with the terminology, Councilmember Bright. If you want to grandfather them in, it would be indefinite until such time as they didn't renew their permit. Or, I think as you were talking about, you would create a sunset, if you will, that they could operate for five more years, and then there would be a sunset in which they could no longer operate. So perhaps that'll help frame the council discussion.
Okay, so from that perspective, there's a distinction between grandfathering and sunsetting. And so before we get to that discussion, let me throw out one thing just to make sure we're all consistent. So notwithstanding the fact that there's a waiting list, so for future multifamily properties that want to have multiple STRs under common ownership, we don't want to continue that process moving forward. Is there consensus on that?
That would be my suggestion. That would be my preference. And thank you, Mr. Buckingham, for that is why you are where you are and why I am where I am. So thank you.
Okay. And I had thumbs up from the other two council gentlemen. So it looks like we are all in consensus that moving forward, the situation does not propagate itself. So we have the situation where it is currently existing. So perhaps by a show of thumbs or just quick comments, who wants to have the grandfathering discussion? Who wants to have the sunsetting conversation? So Mayor Pro Tem Bright, do you want to have the grandfathering or the sunsetting?
I prefer sunsetting, thank you.
Okay, Council Member Rushing.
Actually, quick question. Outside of the four units that we were just discussing, are there other units in the city that would fall under this?
Yes, we have five permit holders that have multiple units, multifamily buildings and multiple permits within those buildings. So it's
okay. So there's five buildings. Is that correct? Okay.
Five buildings and 15 permits total.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I'm in favor of sunset as well.
Okay. We have two sunsets. Councilmember Robert, I think I saw you with a thumbs up for sunset. Okay. And there is consensus, just to kind of throw out my quick comment, I actually probably would have gone for grandfathering with a discussion on stricter violation conversations. But I think that we haven't flushed that out. So I think sunsetting is the appropriate conversation to have at this point. So let's see if there is someone who wants to make a recommendation on a date for the years of sunsetting. Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Well, I'd really like to hear what you have to say. I mean, since we're here, if you don't mind, and my colleagues don't mind, I'd like, because it is important and it is people's investments and so on, I would really like to hear what you have to say. I haven't thought of everything, and so I'd like to hear what you have to say, if you don't mind.
Not a problem. I appreciate that. I think my thought was, as represented by Mr. Castillo, is these five property owners have not generated any of the notice of violation complaints, and so they're very diligent with, and is that correct, Mr. Castillo, Mr. Buckingham? Did I hear that correctly previously?
No, we didn't get into the discussion, but that is correct. They are, as Diane hinted, they all of them have not generated, well, I can't say all of them, four of the five of them have not generated complaints. Of those, two of them are rather large contributors to TOT. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay, very good. So I think, obviously, the opportunity to have those as professional generators of TOT, and they're definitely doing the opportunity of policing and professional management and so forth, I think lends to the opportunity for continuing that service. But then I guess my thought was if there do start to be concerns generating of violations and so forth, that we put a kind of a stricter cap on those from a violation standpoint. I'm not sure how we do that, but perhaps it's a generation of conformity and making sure, kind of incentivizing the owners to make sure that they are following the rules in order to maintain those permits. And if not, then we start to grandfather the permits or sunset the permits away from that activity. So since they are they seem to be all professional services towards that, they're going to do their best to make sure that they're complying with all the rules. And so that's my kind of not well phrased discussion for grandfathering, but I do see Councilmember Robert with a hand raised, so I'll let him add to the conversation.
Well, after listening to the discussion, I think maybe I might change my position on this. If we only have five buildings that are doing this, we don't have an outbreak of hotels in the city, which is what we're trying to avoid, which we will avoid in the future by changing this ordinance. Maybe we should consider grandfathering these people in and requiring stricter rules, perhaps. Either that or, yeah, no, I'm just going to leave it at that. So I would side with you, Mayor, if then possibly maybe we shouldn't just get rid of them. These people have invested a lot of time and money on developing these things and obviously taking well care of them, no complaints from the neighbors. So that's it.
Okay. Anyone else want to add to that conversation? Councilmember Rushing.
Please.
Actually, go to Councilmember Rushing first, and back to the Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you, sir. Just confirming one more time. So we're talking about 15 total units at this point, right, Mr. Castillo?
Right. We are talking about 15 total unit or 15 total permits within five buildings in the city. Within five buildings
out,
in the city.
Out of the 60 total that we have in the non-coastal.
One of these permit holders is in the coastal zone. The other four are in the non-coastal.
Okay.
So it's just the one. And just to give context, Diane is the only one that is in the coastal zone.
Okay, got it. And to Councilmember Roberts' point as well, I mean, there is a lot of money that's involved with these, and the folks that came into these conversations came in with good faith with the city, and we established what our rules were and said that this is the process by which you can do a short-term rental within our city. These are the fees that you have to pay. These are the pieces of paper that you have to fill out. And my gut check when I found out how many units were actually multi-units sort of caught me off guard, because I was actually going for grandfathered as well at the beginning, and then I went back into the sunset. So at this point, we started a conversation with them in good faith, and they did as well, and I think that going forward with the grandfathering for these folks would honestly be the right thing to do.
Very good. Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Thank you. Yes, when you don't have all the information, you don't make the best decisions. And I didn't realize that. First of all, we have had no complaints. We didn't have any calls from any of the neighbors from these properties that I know of. I didn't realize that we'd had very few complaints from these properties. And so I really do believe that I kind of jumped the gun here. And I thought that there were a lot more of these types of developments in our city. So I agree with you, Mayor, and my colleagues that I really do think that I think that grandfathering is the appropriate thing to do here in this instance. I don't know that this is something that I'd want to continue to do, but we've done it, and we entered into these agreements with these folks, and I think we need to honor it. So, as you said, maybe stricter requirements as we go forward, if necessary. But I do believe that grandfathering at this point is probably the most appropriate measure to take at this point in time.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Good.
Thank you, everyone, for that input. Maybe let me bring it back to kind of just making sure we've got all the consensus, because I'm seeing our city attorney squirm. So I'm thinking that if we go towards stricter violation policies, we might end up modifying or needing to modify an ordinance, which I don't think we is part of the discussion yet here tonight. So let me try this and make sure that we get to a point of good decision. Is we'll consider grandfathering in those existing units, and with the caveat that if ownership changes or they don't follow the number of stays minimum that we have, that those are then revoked. Or going go out of the STRs and then back into the number. And so I see by Mr. Castillo's hands, he may have a clarification for what I just mentioned.
Right. So I just want to have it very clear that the council's direction in terms of the minimum number stays is for each permit, not just for the building. Thank you. Because there are
So it'd be for each permit on the property. Great. Thank you. So. Does that make sense to folks? I'll turn to Mr. Buckingham since he has something to input.
I just wanted to agree with the council that if you're going to grandfather these in, they should just continue to have to play by the same rules as everybody else. So if there are violations, it's just like any other, they have a chance to address them and basically are three strikes and you're out, and then we would revoke the permit consistent with the ordinance.
So, but just to confirm that if one of them does drop out, so that goes back into the available permits and it would not be available for that unit that dropped out of the program.
Correct. Just like anybody else who has an STR permit today, if they don't meet these minimum requirements, then they would be revoked or not renewed.
Very good. But also, in the case of that happening, they would not be able to join back into the program. So that let's say there's a four units, all four have STRs. One of them changes ownership. The permit goes back into the city, and that one is no longer available for a future STR.
That is correct.
Okay. Very good. I think we're all on the same page there. Everybody, consensus. Very good. Okay, great. Any additional items to talk about on this item? Very good. I'm seeing everybody shaking their heads that we're good. So let's conclude work on that item and let's take about a 10-minute break. We'll come back at about 8:12 as my brain is trying to figure out how to stay inside its head. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you in 10 minutes. Offer folks that want to make public comment on this item to call in at 805-321-6639, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Ray.
I just realized I was muted. Let me repeat that. Thank you, Honorable Mayor. It's good to see you this evening and City Council. As the Mayor mentioned, this is an item on sidewalk infill policy and cost sharing program. And if you can please, Ms. Sims, move to the next slide. Thank you. So as the council knows, our major goals include street improvements, public safety, with other important goals, including pedestrian, bicycle, and traffic safety. The city has infilled sidewalk historically using general funds in conjunction primarily with major K-14 projects or with other funding sources such as the Safe Routes to School grant, which we received last year. With the city's positive fiscal condition, the current CIP allocates $250,000 in general funds for sidewalk infill in fiscal year 22, with an additional $50,000 per year through fiscal year 26. Next slide. Here's a couple of photos of just some sidewalk infill so everybody understands what we're talking about. Basically, putting sidewalk in between existing sidewalk to create a contiguous sidewalk in that block. Next slide. So staff has completed a planning level sidewalk inventory for council's prior direction. That's attachment one in your staff report. And I do say planning level because this is not intended to be a super accurate inventory of all sidewalks. But you know, it was allowed us to get to this discussion this evening. There are 1,241 city blocks identified, and 59% of city blocks have completed sidewalk. 9% have sidewalk on but are close to complete, and 26% have some sidewalk, and 6% have no sidewalk. So we're looking pretty good. Unfortunately, there's an estimated $38 million cost to infill all remaining sidewalks in the city. So, you know, based on that cost and limited resources, to some extent, staff recommends policy that establishes priorities for sidewalk infill, which is why we're here again this evening. Next slide. So staff has made the following policy recommendations. Staff is recommending as a priority one to complete sidewalk infill on all major streets and within two blocks of points of interest. And primarily that would be parks, schools, and city facilities such as the Ramona Center. And major streets for just council's understanding includes 4th, West Grand Avenue, Oak Park, 13th, Farrell, and the Pike. These are all identified in attachment 2, and that shows also the cluster of sidewalks around what we're calling points of interest. Staff is recommending as a second priority to complete additional sidewalk infill in a grid pattern. You know, that's what's unique about our city is that our streets are in a grid pattern. So if we complete a grid pattern of sidewalk infill with a goal of no more than 3 streets apart, between complete sidewalks end to end, residents would only need to walk basically 1 or 2 blocks to access an uninterrupted sidewalk. And you can see that priority 2 recommendation in attachment 3 to your staff report. And I do have expanded maps I can show you in a minute. The exact size of that grid, you know, whether it's 3 blocks exactly, would be determined by selecting blocks with the least amount of infill needed. And again, that is represented in attachment 3. And then priority 3 would really just be to complete the remaining sidewalk. But certainly, given the cost constraints, we would suggest the council approve a prioritization of infill in areas where there's existing curb and gutter and few right-of-way impediments. Next slide. So here you see the priority 1 areas. Those are in red. You see the clusters around Ramona Center, around the elementary schools and our parks. And, you know, that's not a terrible grid of sidewalks, although you do see in the westernmost portion of the city, you know, there's a lot of empty space there. So moving on to priority 2. This map does show our recommended second priorities. And you can see priority 1 again on this map in dashed red this time. And then really this just shows based on our priority 2 recommendation, that is creating this grid network. You can see how that grid network falls in the manner that we have identified that priority, and that is completing sidewalks where you get the most bang for the buck. So if you're looking at the blue lines in this priority 2 recommendation, those are streets that have sidewalk already on at least one side. Green lines identify streets where we'll really only need additional infill on one block. And then moving to yellow, 2 blocks, orange, 3 blocks, purple, 4 blocks, and black, 5+ blocks. But this is the anticipated grid that staff is recommending. And you'll note that pretty much anywhere within the city, you can walk really 1 block in any direction, or the most 2. And you could, if we completed all these priority 2 and priority 1 projects, reach within 2 blocks of you a complete sidewalk end to end in the city. Next slide. So Staff is recommending also pursuing a community development block grant funding application to address priority one projects. Staff is estimating that roughly 77% of priority one could be completed with a $2 million CDBG award, that's community development block grant. But we're not capping ourselves to applying for that. We'll apply for as much as we can possibly get and hope for the best. We would need, at $2 million, we would need an additional $600,000 to complete priority one. And our staff estimate is that could be done within 10 years. Staff is also estimating a cost of $1.5 million to complete priority two. And that includes infill on just one side of 30 city blocks. And note that there is some overlap, which will allow priority two areas to be completed while completing priority one. So, you know, some of that infill around schools and parks is also meeting the priority two criteria of not having to walk more than a couple blocks to reach a contiguous sidewalk. Next slide. The city currently funds design of sidewalk infill. Now we're moving on to cost sharing, a sidewalk infill cost sharing. And so the city funds design of sidewalk infill requests on major K-14 projects, and property owners fund construction. We're calling this our public-private partnership program, and we offer people this opportunity when we put our major K-14 projects out to bid. We notify homeowners that they have this opportunity for basically free design if they'll fund the cost of construction. Council did request that staff revise this program at the April 12th City Council meeting. And based on the staff's or council's recommendation of up to 50%, funding up to 50% of construction costs, staff is recommending that the city, in fact, fund somewhere between 25 and 50% of construction costs. For council's understanding of this, the average cost for a single property frontage is roughly $8,000 in construction costs. And as we know, that can be and has been prohibitive for many property owners. Staff recommends funding a first come, first serve program. That is that as you make applications, we would basically expend available funding, and then folks would have to wait till the following year for additional funding. And based on the 25 to 50% recommendation, staff is recommending a funding allocation between $50,000 and $100,000 annually. And then here's some of the nuances related to that. You know, the best bang for the buck for the city right now is to allow eligibility only for properties fronting streets in upcoming major K-14 projects. Now, we say that because really that means that we have a design effort in the process. We have, you know, we'll be going out to bidding with a contractor, and we can get the best price for the city, which means extending this private public partnership as much as we can with the available funding based on that procedure, only for upcoming K-14 projects. Now, that's not to say that if we don't fully expend the funds in a particular year on upcoming major K-14 projects, we could consider folks on past major K-14 projects who may have been dissuaded based on that roughly $8,000 cost per frontage. So that would be a consideration. And staff recommends exclusion of undeveloped properties because, as the council knows, the development code does require that undeveloped properties currently make improvements to their own frontages. Next slide. So looking at the fiscal impact before we get to kind of a return back to the policy questions we're asking the council, sidewalk infill design, we currently have $200,000 identified in the capital improvement program, which is there to have a shovel-ready project waiting for the CDB project grant application. And that is focused entirely on priority one sidewalk infill as identified in the attachment. Continued investment in sidewalk infill projects currently, we have $250,000 in the five-year CIP, which would be used to fund priorities one and two. And staff is making a recommendation for an additional annual allocation of between $50,000 and $100,000 for this public-private partnership, which would allow sidewalk infill for private residences as we move along. And with that, next slide. Staff is seeking council direction on the infill policy, basically two items. Does council concur with staff's recommendation on priorities 1 through 3 for sidewalk infill? Or would, of course, would council like to make some minor modifications to that? Based on staff's recommendation, we have $2.6 million estimated for priority 1 and $1.5 million estimated cost for priority 2 construction. And then secondly, can council provide cost sharing policy direction with regard to our public-private partnerships, wherein we're recommending extending between 25 and 50% of the construction cost to incentivize construction along of sidewalk infill along with our major K-14 street projects. With that, staff is again recommending, one more second on that slide. Thanks, Wendy. It's coming back. There it is. Staff is recommending between $50,000 and $100,000 additional allocation for this proposed first come, first serve application process. And that would fund between 6 and 13 frontages per year, which would exceed the current success rate we've had with the program so far. And again, that would primarily be limited to upcoming major K-14 projects with an asterisk there that if we did not expend all the funds, we could consider past projects, which would be more expensive for the city because of the design and construction costs. With that, I will turn it over to the council for questions and policy direction. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Ray, for that presentation. So let's check in with council members and see who might have questions. Let's start with Mayor Pro Tem Wright.
Thank you. I only have one question. This is very exciting. I'll keep my comments until later. So my one question is regarding the property owner, and on page 2 at the bottom, we talk about if a property owner commits to funding the remainder of the cost. How are they going to commit?
With our program currently, we have a paperwork that was developed in with assistance from our city attorney that does in fact commit them in signature paying the cost. And we actually don't do the work until they pay. So it's not like we do the work and then hope to be reimbursed for it. They pay us in advance. So we get an application, We give them an estimate, they give us a check, we go ahead.
Okay, very good. So we're not doing a bunch of design work and all like that, only to find out that then they decide, no, we don't want to do it. And so we're not out a bunch of staff time and so on. Okay, well, that's good to know. All right, that was my question. Thank you very much.
Very good. And before I go to Councilmember Roberts, I'll invite anyone that wants to call in for public comment on this item to do so at 805-321-6639. And now I'll turn to Councilmember Roberts.
Thank you, Mayor. No questions, just comments. I'll hold those. Yeah.
Very good. Councilmember Rushing.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Ray, has there been any discussion on the staff level regarding incentivizing full blocks, working with the K-14 to fix their sidewalks? It just seems to me that if we have a piecemeal approach to it, that we might just end up with a sidewalk and then a blank and a sidewalk and a blank. Is there anything that has been discussed about making it more, advantageous for our citizens to complete their blocks out?
I would say, if I may merely answer, okay. I would say no, not in particular. However, if you look at council direction with regard to Measure K-14, that is to focus the K-14 project and their priority on contiguous blocks, north, south, or east to west, on contiguous streets, I should say, north, south, east to west. The opportunities for sidewalk infill certainly and public-private partnerships certainly occur in that manner. But we haven't really thought about, you know, what if maybe we offered an even higher percentage of city participation if, for example, an entire block were willing to, you know, do their infill. I understand. I've understood your question correctly. I wonder how that might work, given that, you know, some blocks only have one property left, whereas others maybe have, you know, 10. So there would be an odd comparison there. But I like the idea, and we just haven't considered it.
Understood. Thank you.
Very good. I didn't have any further questions either. Thank you, everyone, for those questions. And we'll look forward to comments after public comment, where we'll invite folks to do so at 805-321-6639. And I'll turn it over to our city clerk to see if there's anyone who's joined us for public comment on this item.
Yes, we have David Swift.
Hi, Mayor Lee and Council.
Good evening.
I would just like to begin with, this is a great idea. The fact that you're embracing a public-private option for street improvement really is good to hear. I will say that having rehabilitated an entire corner at Atlantic City and 11th, and the cost of that to my remodel project, I would hope that you guys would consider a reimbursement approach where, as part of my overall project, you would look at reimbursing the homeowner for the cost of those street improvements. I do believe that as a homeowner, I actually can competitively bid the concrete work cheaper than the city can at prevailing wages. And so what I did on that corner, I think I probably did cheaper than the city could have done through SUSE, for example. And so, again, I do commend the idea. I do hope that you'll look at some options for, one, helping the homeowners that are doing remodels to include those improvements as part of their projects and do it in a cost-effective way. Thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments, Mr. Swift. Let's see if there's anyone else who's joined us for public comment on this item.
No, we have no other callers.
Very good, thank you. I will go ahead and close public comment, bring it back to the council for the comments and consideration. Let me ask, and I'm not sure if this goes towards Mr. Bronson or Mr. Hale, but Mr. Swift brought up an idea, or perhaps Mr. Ray, reimbursing the homeowners for either past or future projects. Let's consider future projects for the moment. If someone was to come to us and say, if I put it in and we reimburse for that, does that trigger some level of prevailing wage at a certain threshold, or is there a kind of a matching program that we could do similar to what is in the staff report of like a 50-50 split or a 50-50% match? Is that an option?
I think I'd have to say that anytime you put public money into a project, and ultimately I will assume, and Mr. Ray can correct me if I'm wrong, that these improvements end up being city improvements, and we put public money into it, then you have to consider whether it does trigger prevailing wage or not. I think we would have to look at the overall project as a whole and look at what the contribution amount is. In other words, if sidewalks were part of an overall three-unit complex that private project had as a requirement the building of sidewalks, and we were to agree to reimburse a certain portion of that, I would hazard a guess that would be a de minimis contribution. Therefore, would it trigger prevailing wage? No. But it's really a case-by-case analysis that we'd have to look at. But the concept in and of itself is not necessarily offensive or potentially illegal. The city could potentially participate in that. We just have to look at it.
Okay. Very good. I'll turn to Mr. Ray to add to that conversation.
Yeah, I would just point out to the council that at an upcoming council meeting, the development code will be before you, which is have been discussed by the Planning Commission in advance of your meeting. And that part of the development code update that are being considered, what are the thresholds for requiring those frontage improvements? So perhaps since now, clearly Mr. Swift's project, as I understand it, met the threshold to require the public improvements, that's a requirement, but if those thresholds were reduced or increased or however the council felt in that regard, that might bring up an opportunity at that time to discuss a different type of incentive program relative to that, relative to people that don't meet that threshold. So, and I would just comment that as far as we're aware, these are public works projects. We're applying prevailing wage to them. Maybe there would be an exemption, but I'm not aware of one. So.
Gotcha. Okay, so it sounds like this is more of an appropriate conversation for that development code update, or perhaps a tease for our October 5th housing discussion that we're having next Monday as well. So would that be a more appropriate place to have that conversation?
I would say so, yes, probably.
Okay, very good. Any concern by any council members to kind of have that discussion at that later date? We'll kind of stick with where we are currently. Okay, great. So thank you for that. So we'll kind of put that discussion on hold for a moment and turn back to kind of the what's before us. And if we use the similar format that we did from our prior item, let's go through what staff has presented to us and kind of have comments on each of those items. So if I'm remembering it correctly, and Mr. Ray, as always, please feel free to include items that I may miss. So staff's laid out a priority 1, 2, and 3 for kind of infilling of sidewalks. Anybody have any comments or concerns on that prioritization? Let's start with, just go ahead and unmute yourself if you do have any comments you want to make on that priority. Seeing no one unmute themselves, looks like we've got prioritization. So with basically a quick confirmation that the first phase of that would be to utilize our existing CIP program to design the sidewalk infill project in advance of applications for the CDBG funding of upwards of $2 million. And Mr. Bronson, perhaps you can give us an update on when that application might be required for submittal.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Our understanding is that this application deadline would be in February, which would be similar to the 2020 CDBG application deadline for the water main improvements. As the council may recall, we employed a similar strategy of designing improvements so that they were shovel ready as soon as we received the funding. We received the funding last fall, and those projects are under construction as we speak. So we would use the same approach with the sidewalk infill approach of designing the improvements based on the priority one tier pending council direction, and then go forward, apply, hopefully receive the funds, and put them to good use next year.
Very good. And just to confirm, no concern with staff capacity to be able to let that design contract and have that ready for the application deadline?
We are poised and ready.
Very good. Thank you for that. Let's see, just by any comments, anybody have any concerns or want to express any comments on that portion of the discussion? Not seeing anybody unmute themselves. That looks like concurrence to me. So then I think that gets us to our contribution percentages, correct, Mr. Ray?
That is correct.
Very good. So then it looks like what staff is recommending is kind of between 25% and 50%. Anyone have comments as to a place to begin? Do we start at 50% of that, or would a 25%, and perhaps if we did go towards the higher end, we would also make a recommendation if someone came in and there were multiple properties on the street, that they would go and talk with their neighbors and see if there was an opportunity to get from a complete block done. So I don't know, Mr. Rushing, if there's anything that you wanted to add to that conversation, or if you have a preferred percentage?
I don't know proper percentages, but I do like where your brain was going just there. if there was a chance of incentivizing blocks for completing a space, if we could increase the percentage that the city was paying back, I think that would be a better use of city's funds.
Okay. So, Councilmember Robert.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm just concerned. What if have you thought of this? And just tell me, Mr. Ray, if this is just completely ridiculous. But I know sidewalks are very important for a city, and we should have all our sidewalks in place. The cost of doing so is astronomical, and it's only going to get more. And we're asking people to pitch in and split the cost because it's a big benefit to have that in front of their house, obviously. But what when we're doing these streets, the massive amount of streets we're doing, wouldn't it be considerably less if we say we just put the curb and gutter in and have the house people, the people that own the homes, put the sidewalk in, which would be similar to splitting the cost. But I know we can't use the money we have out of cutting the bonds for the curb and gutters. The money probably happens. These other funds, general funds, curb and gutters in. Just on the streets that we're doing complete streets. Is that a consideration or is that just going down a rabbit hole? Thank you.
I'll tell you that the reason staff has recommended the program as we have is that you know, we're trying to extend the Measure K-14 funds as far as possible. We're not using Measure K-14 for sidewalks, but we have in undeveloped property frontages, we are constructing an asphalt curb. And so that greatly reduces our cost of construction. And so, which means that ultimately the homeowner should either if they choose to participate in the public-private partnership, could change and pay the differential cost for concrete curb gutter and sidewalk. But also, I mean, it does save money in the Measure K-14 program, which means that we can address more streets overall with the program. So that's why we had sort of stuck with the public-private partnership and not extending our Measure K-14 costs to include curb and gutter. It's not a bad idea that we do it, but you know, it doesn't us constructing curb and gutter doesn't necessarily imply that the homeowner will in fact still want to pay the roughly $6,000 or $7,000 for the sidewalk that remains to be constructed.
Okay, thank you.
And Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Thank you. Well, this whole concept is incredibly exciting. It's a major improvement to the entire city with street improvements along with sidewalk infill. So I'm kind of leaning towards the 50%, mainly because of what I consider to be a private property value increase that people are going to see, which they've seen just because of the street improvements. So even if you already have a sidewalk in front of your house, if your neighbor now constructs a sidewalk in front of their house, and or you have a complete block of sidewalk and curb, it's going to be nothing but a property value increase to your home and your entire block. So I just find it to be just such a major improvement to our entire city. It's not only that's going to increase our bond value, everything. So I think though that if we're talking on half of say $7,000 or $6,000, that is something that a homeowner could actually even maybe put on their credit card or something along those lines. I think it is for maybe the average family, it is a doable expense. So that is what we're talking about right now, right? We're at that level, are we? Okay.
Yep.
So I'm in 50% level. That's what I think. If this had only been available 20 years ago, it would have been wonderful for me and my family. So I think it is, I think it's an excellent incentive, and I'm just happy to see it happening. So that's my comment on this portion of this agenda item. Thank you.
Very good. So I think I am kind of concurring with the 50% contribution as well, because I kind of take a look at the initial part of the program where we're going to get plus or minus $2 million worth of sidewalks constructed for the community. And that's going to get us to that place to where plus or minus every two blocks, you've got a very realistic walk without the availability of a sidewalk. So I think having that program and that availability is going to be a wonderful thing for Grover Beach. So beyond that, I think as represented in the staff report, kind of like a cash for grass type of program, to where we contribute that 50% mechanism towards someone who's willing to invest in their property frontage, and if they can use peer pressure or some sort of persuasion along with their neighbors, they're all going to get the same benefit. But as we go through and build five segments of sidewalk, hopefully we'll get a better price from the contractor, and it'll be a better investment for the homeowners. So I think I'd be kind of good with just starting and staying at that 50% contribution rate when it comes to that. But I'll turn to Mr. Ray for a moment, because it looks like he has something to share.
As council's homing in on a recommend or a policy direction for a percentage of city participation, keeping in also tracking Councilmember Rushing's suggestion, along with others who suggested maybe to further incentivize an entire block. What if, again, depending on council's recommended budget allocation for this, which we're recommending between $50,000 and $100,000, we offer an additional 1-2% bonus for each additional property frontage that participates in the program in a particular block. So if we're doing a major paving project and there's three sidewalk infills on a block, we could have up to maybe a 3% city participation bonus if the particular first applicant can convince their neighbors, the other two neighbors, to participate. That might be a way to sort of have that incentivized. It's not huge, but it's definitely something. And that might, and also would be keeping with the budget recommendation.
So I like your thinking, but I'm almost concerned that it might add too much difficulty for staff to start tracking something like that, and I don't want to use unintended persuasion to get us to that point. But I'll turn to Mr. Bronson, as he's unmuted himself, to add to that discussion.
Yeah, I appreciate the thought that Mr. Ray put in to try to meet the interest. I think it's a good concept. I do share a little bit of concern regarding our ability to track that, given the limited bandwidth of our mighty Public Works team. And I wonder whether the comment that the mayor mentioned about how getting more properties to participate would lower the overall marginal cost and provide some degree of cost incentive for those to be part of the program. It's kind of a way of bringing more persuasion, because they would see a slightly lower cost as more homeowners, property owners were part of the program. It could achieve the same goal that the council's looking for, in a way that's easier to track than adding a bonus point. But again, we're trying to meet the interest and seeing as many different blocks as we have going forward. And thank you, Mr. Ray, for brainstorming with us and figuring out how that could work.
Very good. So in kind of the interest of discussion, so are we, do we need to have any other further consensus building on the 50%? I know Councilmember Robert may not be all the way there, but I want to give him an opportunity to weigh in or to either agree or persuade us to go with a different percentage.
No, I agree with the 50%. I had no problem with that. But my concern is, this might be a different discussion, stop me if it is, the $100,000, that seems like, I mean, one project would take it all up. They're just limiting ourselves at 100,000.
Okay. And so, yeah, let's hold that discussion for just a moment. But let's make sure that everybody's good with the 50% contribution. So discussion. Okay, cool. Okay, very good. So I think we've got consensus there. So now let's go back to what Councilmember Robert was just talking about, is effectively the way staff has put it in the staff report is kind of a first come, first serve, approximately $50,000 to $100,000 per year for those sidewalks, and realizing it may be one project, it may be six projects. So perhaps staff can opine on the fact of how utilized this program might be, or perhaps it's a matter of we start with this contribution amount and kind of revisit it at the budget next year and see if it's completely used up, then we say it's a very exciting program, people, we need to fund it further. I see some shaking of heads, so that maybe the approach is that we fund it at the current level as recommended by staff, and then kind of verify it at the budget check-in. Is that a good approach? Okay, very good. Mr. Ray, Mr. Bronson, any concerns about the direction, or anything you want to clarify?
No concerns about the direction from my end. I'll just add that operationally, we would begin to move forward with this direction and then work to include a mid-year budget appropriation of this first amount, probably with some degree of proration for where we are in the fiscal year, to get started this year, and then we could build this into the annual budget that begins next July.
Very good. Anything else to add, Mr. Ray?
No, that sounds like great direction from my perspective, and I think this is a program that we could definitely work with.
Very good. Definitely appreciate that. And did we capture all the items that you needed for tonight?
Did we home in on the actual budget appropriation, or as Mr. Bronson has mentioned, maybe we prorate between 50 and 100,000 this year and then come back with a recommendation next year for a more exact budget amount based on our success and experience?
I think that was kind of where we landed, and in my opinion, we'll leave that to Mr. Bronson to kind of know the overall idiosyncrasies of the budget and come back with an appropriate number, unless there's council input that we want to have.
Sounds great.
Okay. I think that sounds appropriate, and I'll just thank Mr. Wright and the Public Works team for coming up with this revised program and moving forward with the sidewalk infill design work. This is a big deal for us, and I appreciate staff's work in helping get to this point.
Very good. Yes, and I know there was other members of the council and other members of the community that were very interested in making sure that we do have sidewalk infill programs. And so thank you for bringing that back to us for consideration this evening and in direction. So with that, we'll conclude our work on item number 9 and take us to item number 10, where it is a Central Coast Blue update and project framework. And I'll invite those that want to call in for public comment on this item to do so at 805-321-6639. And I'll turn it over to our city manager, Mr. Bronson, to start the conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and council members. I'll be providing this brief presentation this evening on the Central Coast Blue update and project framework. Next slide, please. The council last discussed Central Coast Blue back in March of this year. It was a fairly detailed presentation around the project specifics, technical details, the environmental CEQA analysis. This presentation tonight will not cover those details. This is really covering a new framework around governance, oversight, transparency, and delivery of the project. But just some background information to start with. This is a regional recycled water project that purifies wastewater, injects it in the groundwater basin, and provides ongoing additional water supply and groundwater protection for our basin. The first phase of the project would involve treating Pismo Beach wastewater effluent and injecting it into the groundwater basin. And the second phase, if needed, would also bring in the South Sanitation District effluent and increase the amount of acre feet produced as part of this project. The advanced facility as proposed, would be located in Grover Beach at 980 Huber Street, as shown here on screen, shaded in yellow. It is a largely vacant lot today that would be built with a state-of-the-art industrial facility to then inject the water at a nearby injection well. Next slide, please. The council is well aware that we are in a period of drought for many years back in the early 2010s, and then the last couple of years, our recent dry conditions have really placed a lot of stress on our water supply. Lopez Lake, which is one of our two water supplies, currently has roughly 30% capacity, less than 15,000 acre-feet of water. This is a significant challenge for us in making sure we have enough water supply to meet our needs today and tomorrow. We also have seawater intrusion that we're trying to prevent in our groundwater basin, which is our second source of water. We are working with our neighboring agencies, Arroyo Grande and Pismo Beach, to help develop this project that is a unique partnership amongst three cities working together to provide additional water supply, also working with our partners at Oceano CSD, the South Sand District, and the County of San Luis Obispo. Next slide, please. We've been working on this framework for this project, cost-benefit sharing, for the last couple of years. And it really came to culmination last year in developing a framework that was presented to our council in January of 2020, an updated version in June of 2020 that led into 9 months of work that culminated in an operating agreement that was approved by your council back in March of this year. There were some concerns raised subsequently as part of that approval process by our neighboring community in Arroyo Grande, and any kind of partnership involves working through issues, working through concerns, and trying to get to a place where we can work together as a region. The concerns and questions led to a number of months of actions, discussions, conversations, and culminating in a requested revision of the agreement by the City of Arroyo Grande in June of 2021. That led to the three city managers of our communities to work together on a new framework that would keep all three cities together on this important regional project that we all need for the betterment of our water supply. We worked very diligently to get to a point where we're at today of having a new framework that we believe will keep this project back on track. Next slide, please. The framework, as articulated and shown in the attachments to the staff report, involves a number of key details. One is that the City of Pismo Beach would remain the lead agency for this important project through project construction, having one lead agency to handle the bidding, to handle the project oversight, helps to streamline the process and make it more efficient. The cost would still be shared by the three agencies based on an equitable, agreed-upon cost-share structure. Each council, each of the three councils, would approve the project scope and the budget, and the project would be required to stick to that, much like we do with the county animal shelter currently under construction right now. If there were costs above and beyond that agreed upon budget, each council would have to approve those costs as well. So that brings in that check and balance into the process and the oversight each council is looking for. The councils would have a joint meeting once or twice a year, all three councils, to come together and discuss the project, provide information and input into project outcomes, discuss policy issues such as local hire provisions, which has been a key point of conversation amongst the three different councils and is a point that would come up in this joint meeting. I'll just add that there has never been a joint meeting of all three councils on the topic of water supply. So this would be a new concept and one that is very worthy of this important project. At the same time, there'd be a staff level technical advisory committee to meet monthly and really get into the nitty-gritty of providing oversight and monitoring of this important project, and then helping to inform our elected officials, our policymakers, in this joint meeting occasionally throughout the year. One of the biggest changes is that there would be a joint powers authority, a JPA, formed to assume ownership and operation of the facility upon project completion. And that is in response to the interest in having an equitable decision-making model similar to what we have with the Five Cities Fire Authority, the South Sanitation District, and other models of having different votes be considered equally as part of the board process, having a technical advisory committee supporting the JPA as well. So it would transition from a Pismo Beach-led construction project into an equal JPA model upon operation of the facility. And lastly, this framework does not assume any groundwater pumping limitations on the participants. There's a separate process, a separate discussion around groundwater pumping that Mr. Ray is very involved in with his colleagues and other agencies. This framework does not speak to that process. Next slide, please. So the recommendation before the council is to authorize city manager to negotiate a cost-sharing agreement and joint powers agreement consistent with the framework as highlighted in the presentation and attached to your staff report. I'll note that the Rio Grande Council has recently provided this authorization to its city manager consistent with the framework, and we expect a subsequent action by the Pismo Beach City Council following our action this evening. I'll note that we are on a track to bring the cost sharing agreement and JPA agreements to our councils by the end of 2021. And that would include additional information about the project, the technical aspects, the permitting requirements, where we are with the costs of the project today, and the grant funding that we are anticipated to receive for this project. We are working towards receiving $40 million of grant funding through federal and state grant processes. We've already received over $5 million, and we're on track for applying for another almost $30 million in the next couple of months to help fund up to three-quarters of the cost of this project. We would expect this joint council meeting to be convened for the first time in early 2022, which would coincide with the final design, the regulatory permitting process, and ultimately construction taking place beginning in mid-2023 for this critical project to supply future water needs. Next slide, please. With that, I'll be glad to take your questions and comments.
Very good. Thank you for that update, Mr. Bronson. I appreciate the thoroughness of that and kind of walking us through where we were and where we are currently. So let's check in with council members and see if there's any questions before we go out to public comment. So I'll start with Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Thank you. Just excellent report. So I just have two questions, but fast, if you don't mind. In the agreement itself, on the second page, identify intent to treat Central Coast Blue Water as new development water under the terms of the 2005 stipulation. Can you just talk about that for a second or two, please? Is this getting too much into the weeds?
Well, I will take that question, Mayor Pro Tem Bright, and pass it to my colleague, Mr. Ray, who can speak much more about how this would be truly new water beyond what's in this stipulation from 2005.
So the term new developed water has nothing to do with development, as in building of homes and new commercial properties. It means that essentially this is developed water that did not exist in our groundwater basin. That's important because this water is going to be injected into the groundwater basin and then extracted back out a distance away for reuse. But what it basically says is that per the stipulation in the court ruling, no one else has any rights to that water except for those who developed it. So that's the answer.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Now, will you allow me one more question? I know we don't want to delve too deep into this business, but I just have to ask. Under the other issues of concern, the first bullet, the last question says, any proposed groundwater pumping limitations will be addressed through amendments to the NCMA, the Northern Counties Management Agreement, or whatever that is, Management Agreement. And the NCMA so, Management
Agreement. Correct. So per the settlement that was reached with the landowner groups, Santa Maria Valley folks and ourselves, we have a total allocation for the Northern Cities Management Area, which is essentially the farmers very near to us, Rio Grande, Grover Beach, Pismo Beach, and Oceana Community Service District. Those areas have a maximum allocation each year that will likely be updated based on changing groundwater conditions and new information. So So that's where those issues of groundwater pumping limitations are properly addressed, is in our regular interaction on an annual basis with the court relative to our management of our groundwater basin. That's what that relates to.
So are they going to, you know, we'll talk about this later. I don't want to get into the nuts and bolts. That really doesn't have a whole lot to do with what we're trying to do here. So I'll ask you, I'll send you an email and we can talk about this later. So thank you. I really wanted to know about that new development water. That was really my big question. So thank you very much. I appreciate the information. And I'll give my time over. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Next, I'll go to Councilmember Robert and see if he has any questions for staff.
No questions. Thank you, Mayor.
Very good. Councilmember Rushing.
No, I love this framework and I look forward to talking about it further.
Very good. And I didn't have any questions either. So Mr. Bronson put together some good comments on the technical side of it and on the permitting side of it that obviously will be future discussion items once this framework kind of continues to move forward. So I look forward to comments after public comment, and I'll invite any member of the public to call in at 805-321-6639, and I'll check in with our city clerk, see if anyone has joined us for public comment on this item.
No, we have no one on the line.
Very good. I will go ahead and close public comment on this item and bring it back to the council for consideration and comments. So since Mayor Pro Tem Bright yielded her time, I'll start with Councilmember Rushing and see if he has any questions or any comments on the framework.
No, I think we've all been waiting for this framework to come into place. And I, for one, am excited that we have three cities willing and ready and able to move forward with a project that I think, I personally believe is critical to the future of our communities. So thank you everyone for pulling this together. I appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you for those comments. Next, I'll turn to Councilmember Roberts.
Ditto, our Councilmember Rushing's comments. Very exciting that we're finally moving forward. We need to get those ducks filled up. Okay, thank you.
Very good. Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
I agree. And I do very much want to thank Matt for his hard work and diligence to keep this thing moving forward and getting all three cities back on track. And I'm incredibly happy and excited about the possibilities for those grant funds. That's going to mean all that the less we have to invest, the better for everyone. So that sounds just so exciting. So great news. Thank you.
Very good. And I will echo those sentiments as well and say thank you to Mr. Bronson and Mr. Ray for continuing to work on this and continuing to make sure that we have a framework for stability when it comes to Central Coast Blue. Obviously, this is the first of several very exciting hurdles and obstacles to overcome. But without this first hurdle overcome, we can't get to the second one. So with that, if someone is ready to make a motion to authorize the action, I'll go ahead and accept that.
Well, I'll make that motion. Staff's recommendation.
I will second that. Thank you. Sorry, Robert.
Very good. We have a motion and a second. Madam City Clerk, roll call, please.
Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Yes.
Councilmember Rushing.
Yes.
Councilmember Robert.
Yes.
Mayor Lee.
Yes. Very good. So we have a framework for Central Coast Blue. Two out of the three cities have now taken action. I'm not sure, Mr. Bronson, if you have a date certain for when Pismo is going to consider this.
I do not at this time, but I do know that they are moving forward with updating the contract for the design work and grant application process. So this train continues to move, and I thank the council for your leadership and your vote this evening.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for your work on that. So that'll conclude our action on item number 10. So seeing as we haven't had members of the public online for public communication for the last couple items, we'll go ahead and skip our second set of public comments and go to council committee reports. And I'll turn to council member Robert first for any committee assignment reports that he wants to update us on.
I do. Okay. So we have some ongoing updates and summaries for their RAC committee. Their continued updates on the rain and reservoir reports, California drought monitoring summary. We got some action going with the groundwater basin management efforts. It's a big deal. Integrated regional water management and some stormwater resource plans they're working on now. Various county water programs and policies and ordinances. Very complicated water stuff, which fits right in with the Pacific Coast Blue. And they had the committee received a presentation from the staff regarding the draft regional water infrastructure resilient plan, which is also quite complicated. The committee will be hosting an urban poor focused drought panel featuring Scott Halbert, who is the lead for the drought task force for the County of San Luis Obispo. The panel members will include Ben Fine, he's the director, public director in the Pismo Beach, the city of Pismo Beach, and Ray Dienzo, thank you, Dienzo, Cambria Community Service District. And we're going to have another meeting next week, and I'll get some more information on those things. So that's my report. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for that report. Next, we'll go to Councilmember Rushing for any community assignment reports that he might have.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have two committees to talk about today. I'll start off with REACH and the SLO Advisory Commission. We met last week and had a couple of really awesome presentations from two folks. First was Ron Gonzalez from Phillips 66. Talking about the impending decommissioning of that facility and the remediation process that is involved, and the open-ended search for what is going to happen in that space in the future. That is definitely what REACH is all about. It's about figuring out how we're going to take projects that we might no longer have in the future and turn them into awesome, amazing jobs for the Central Coast. So looking forward to seeing how that proceeds as well. We also spoke with Nick Tompkins, who is in charge of the Dana Reserve project down in Napomo, which is going to be a very, very interesting mixed-use residential project with affordable housing and market housing and a bunch of amazing other things involved, including retail and restaurants. It's very cool. I recommend anybody that's online, go check it out, Google it. It's very awesome. I'm going to move on to the South County Chamber of Commerce, though. At the Government Affairs Committee meeting most recently, we had a very informative conversation about the county's current efforts for redistricting, just like Grover Beach. Grover Beach is, of course, in the process of starting a districting process, and every 10 years the county does the exact same thing. So it was incredibly refreshing to see that the county is going through the exact same thing that we are right now, trying to go through all of the data and figuring out what our communities of interest are, and encouraging local constituents to get involved, take a look at the maps, and figure out where their representatives need to be. And that's all I have today. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you for those updates. And next we'll turn to Mayor Pro Tem Bright for any updates from her committees.
Thank you. Air Pollution Control District. A couple of things that folks might be interested in. We had a grant program update. One of the things that I think people may not be aware of, and that is APCD has been managing an incentive program it's called Old Car Buyback. So if you have a 1997 car or older that maybe can't pass smog or whatever, they will buy it back from you for $1,000. So you can go on their website and check that out. APCD and Cal Fire has also suspended all outdoor burns, so you can't get a permit for that anymore at this point in time. I'm thinking that might be, there's also a commercial harbor craft registration amendment that's going on through CARB, California Air Resources Board. Sorry about the acronym there. And APCD is hoping to assist with grant funds. There's more time needed because the grant funds require minimum compliance deadlines and so on. And so they're working really hard to get CARB to allow them to get more information, more time so that the local fishermen have time to comply with these deadlines. I don't think people really realize how hard the APCD works to try and help our local fishermen, farmers, and so on to comply with these state regulations that come down and help them to get new engines and retrofit their equipment so that they are able to comply with the new regulations that come along. So it really is amazing how hard staff works to help our local ag and fishing industry so that they are able to comply with what they need to comply with so that they're not fined and so on, and they can get on with their business. So I'd say that's about all that I have to report. Thank you for the opportunity.
Very good. Thank you for those updates. And I just had some very quick updates. South San, we had which is a sanitation district, we had an update on the redundancy project. Everything is going as planned. It is on time, on schedule, on budget. So I say the on schedule because it is technically, I think it's going to go over by 9 days, but out of the length of time, which is 3 years, 9 days is made up in relatively short order when it comes to that, and they've already got a plan for that. But the district does have its most current flyover of the construction, and you can actually see some of the work being completed in that flyover. So go to the South Sanitation District website, and you can kind of see that. And then the other two committees were basically updates on 5 Cities Fire Authority, on the staffing, and on the budget. Nothing new to add there. And then the annual meeting for the 3CE Energy community meeting culminated with the policy board passing the budget with appropriate programs, which will be coming forward and outlined in an outreach program. So as a follow-up to Mr. Killigrew's presentation last time, you'll be seeing some more outreach for the various programs to help with energy offset and energy incentivizing. So with that, I'll turn it over to our League of California Cities Policy Committee reports. As we all know, we as a city did not choose to participate in the in-person League of California Cities annual conference this year, and I think that was a good choice on our part. But we are able to come back and say that we are part of an award-winning project in the fact that Central Coast Blue, and I don't want to take any thunder away from Mr. Bronson if he was going to share this, but we already do are participating in a award-winning Central Coast Blue project as it was awarded a Helen J. Putnam Award at the League of California Cities last week with that. So With that, I'll turn to our council communications, see if anyone has anything to share. I'll turn to council member Robert first.
Oh, my mic was on. Sorry. Yeah, no, I have no communications to talk about today. Thank you.
Very good. Council member Rushing.
Actually, I don't have anything extra to share today either. Thank you, sir.
Very good. Mayor Pro Tem Bright.
Well, two things. One, I had the privilege of serving at the Empty Bowls activity on Saturday with our mayor and a number of other local dignitaries. It was just a fabulous event, and I was very honored to be able to assist there. And then also, I just wanted to commend our police department for some just being so very active and kind in assisting someone in my neighborhood who really needed assistance. It wasn't on my part. I didn't ask them to do it. They were called to assist, and I just heard about it. And it was somebody who needed health. It was health related, but they were so kind and so compassionate. And I just want to say thank you very much. I don't know who the officer was. I just know that they were very, very kind, and not only kind to the individual, but kind to their animal and my whole neighborhood. Thanks them. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for that input. My council communications this evening are to kind of say thank you to Empty Bowls as well through the Five Cities Homeless Coalition. There were three weekends, and each weekend had some great participation. I got an opportunity hang out with our city manager, Mr. Bronson, and other folks at the Trilogy portion of Empty Bowls, and then obviously with Mayor Pro Tem Bright and her granddaughter Kenzie yesterday at New Life Church in Pismo. So always good to see that. I haven't heard how much has been raised, but I know this has been a very successful program over the last two years as COVID has taken it from an in-person event to for soup and bowls to basically picking up a bowl and then going to participating restaurants to enjoy soup at the restaurants. My only other communication, and again, I'll kind of leave most of this to Mr. Bronson, but the county is, Board of Supervisors is going to have an ordinance as part of their agenda tomorrow to allow for a consideration of pallet houses within county property. And one of the locations under consideration is actually in Grover Beach at county property on Long Branch. So the city manager is going to be available for questions and comments at the board for that item tomorrow. And then also, lastly, a big shout out to our police force again for their quick and decisive communication with some picketers in front of a Lucia Marr board member's house, and actually a former mayor of Grover Beach as well, as there was a disturbance of the peace in front of her house during the course of a meeting, and the police took very decisive action and were able to move those picketers who were creating a public nuisance and move them along to a proper location for their activity. So with that, I'll turn it over to our city manager for his reports and comments.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and council members. First, just dovetailing on some of the comments regarding our police department, I wanted to also echo those comments and just commend them for the job they've done in responding to the picketers that Mr. Mayor mentioned, in responding to a neighbor issue, as Mayor Pro Tem Bright mentioned. They also responded last night to a motorcycle accident on North 4th Street, and it's worked very diligently, quickly, and decisively on investigation, communication, trying to figure out what happened just as efficiently as possible. And that's a hallmark of our police department. I'm really proud of what they do every day. And the men and women of that department serve our community with valor and distinction. Building from there, as the mayor mentioned, the Board of Supervisors is considering an ordinance tomorrow regarding a temporary emergency shelter that's located in Grover Beach for unhoused individuals across our area. It would include up to 20 individual non-congregate housing units called pallet housing units, as this has been an approach used by other communities around the state. First time it's been proposed here in this county. So pending board action tomorrow, this would be installed beginning in January and allow another approach, another solution towards creating shelter spaces where none exist in South County. It's one step of many, but it's an approach that is a unique opportunity for us to work together with the county and the Five Cities Homeless Coalition, which would manage, maintain, and monitor the site to be safe and secure. More information to come once this follows tomorrow's board action, but just to know that our city is part of the conversation, part of the dialogue around this important project. Shifting gears, we have a number of street projects and water main improvement projects underway, primarily in South Grover Beach. You drive down 16th Street and you'll see work on Seabright, Manhattan, Trouville. You see a lot of heavy construction trucks all across the area. That is the sign of progress. New curbs, new corner ramps, new streets, a new multi-use pathway next to Mentone Basin Park. A lot of improvements going on. And again, we are building our way towards an even better city each and every day. We also have new bike racks and new welcome signs that are just about to go in. We installed new bike racks today at some city parks and also on West Grand Avenue in front of where Spoon Trade's located and Julia's Juice Bar in public right-of-way, just to help provide some new bike facilities in a very lively and spirited design to help improve our bike facilities in a very lively way. We also have new welcome signs going up beginning tomorrow at each of the entry points to the city so that the sailboats will continue to sail away from the old design that we had into new, modern, beachy welcome signs that you'll see beginning tomorrow. And lastly, we have a Grover Beach cleanup event coming up this Saturday, October 2nd. We're asking people to meet up at Ramona Park at 10 a.m., and then from there, we'll fan out to different parks and other areas in the city and do some work in sprucing up our fair city. So again, this Saturday, October 2nd, 10 a.m., Ramona Park. We look forward to a great morning of sprucing up across Grover Beach. Thank you, Council.
Question?
Oh, certainly.
Yes,
what, if you want to participate, what should we bring? Can we bring gloves, any kind of gardening utensils, anything like that?
Sure. Thank you for the question. Bringing gloves always is a good idea. We'll have some supplies there. We'll have trash bags, of course. We'll have temporary safety vests. We'll have some reacher grabbers, as my kids call them. But bringing gloves is always a good idea. And from there, just bring in your hard work and community spirit, and we look forward to a great morning.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Bronson, for those updates, and we'll look forward to seeing folks at Ramona Garden Park on October 2nd at 10 a.m. But before I turn it over to Mr. Hale for city attorney reports and comments, I did want to just kind of piggyback one more item on the pallet houses or the ordinance for the non-congregate housing, and the fact that this is kind of the culmination of all of the South County folks, especially Grover Beach, listening to the residents and listening to the fact that there is a need for action to be taken when it comes to homeless services and homeless situations. We've heard the public comments. I'm sure we've all been contacted by members of the public with regards to homeless and homeless activities. And this is an opportunity for us to show the fact that Grover Beach is a city of action and is participating in this with the Five Cities Homeless Coalition, as well as the county, and but also doing, making sure that it's done correctly, that there's security fencing, there's services that are going to be provided and offered for folks that are going to be offered this housing. There's going to be checks and balances along the way as part of this program, and the county with the Five Cities Homeless Coalition and with our police force and with the city staff kind of participating in getting us to this point. I know there's going to be questions from the community. There may be some concerns, but again, this is a point of action that has needed to be taken for a long time, and it gives us an opportunity to reactivate our parks and our public spaces by having a shelter location within close proximity. And I applaud Grover Beach for being able to be part of this step. We've always been that community that has stood up and said, we're willing to take on these hard decisions in order to make this a better community for all of us, the residents that live here, the businesses that work here, and the visitors that come here, with the intent of also being compassionate and caring towards those that are unhoused and food insecure. So with that, I'll close my comments on that and turn it to Mr. Hale for any city attorney reports and comments.
Well, good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm actually going to say something tonight. I can say, with the exception of one very minor code matter, we are still pretty much litigation free. So happy to say that. And I do intend to come to Council the last meeting in October with my performance evaluation. So other than that, nothing else.
Very good. Thank you for those comments. And unless there's anything else that anyone needs to share by unmuting themselves, I see no one doing that. So I'll say thank you, everyone, for your good work this evening. And we are adjourned until next Monday, when we will be having our joint session with the Planning Commission again for our community development workshop. And I see Mr. Bronson probably wanted to mention that earlier.
I did. And actually, just to clarify, it's actually next Tuesday, October 5th. So it's the special meeting date, similar to our last special meeting on Tuesday, September 7th.
Thank you for that clarification. So I won't see you on Monday. I'll see you all next Tuesday. Or actually, I'll see you on Saturday, but I'll see you definitely again on Tuesday. Thanks, everybody. Good work tonight.
Good night. Thank you.